It's time for TWiT This Week at Tech, a live studio audience for the first time in 4 years. Great to have them. Plus Harry McCracken, Lisa Schmeiser, and Micah Sargent. We're going to talk about the House and Senate nearing a deal on a landmark online privacy bill. What are the odds? I think pretty low. What happened to Marissa Meyer's new app and the price of zero-day exploits? North of $20 million. All that and more coming up on TWiT.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT This Week in Tech, episode 974, recorded Sunday, April 7th, 2024. Get at the young-youngs. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. And this is a very special TWiT, not only because I'm wearing a velvet smoking jacket, although...
Less smoking?
It is kind of... Speffy, but because we have an all-in-studio panel, and we have, for the first time since COVID, since 2020, so February 2020, we have an in-studio audience. But I'll introduce the audience later. Let me introduce the panel. Harry McCracken is here, the technologizer from Fast Company.
Hi, Leo.
Hi, Harry. Always good to have you.
Nice to be here.
And Maria's home.
She's at home, but she says hello.
Hi, Marie.
She always enjoys being mentioned by you.
Also here, Lisa Schmeiser, who is editor-in-chief at No Jitter. Mm-hmm. NoJitter.com.
Yes, NoJitter.com. Yep.
What is No Jitter?
No Jitter's an old...
I ask you this every single time.
You do, and I don't mind answering every single time. No Jitter is the... it's a ancient, as in 1990s, telecommunication term for being able to successfully move voice data without dropping any of the data as it moves from point A to point B, creating a jitter in the sound. And No Jitter covers communications and collaborations technology from... from copper wiring all the way up to unified communications.
I will vouch for that because one of the things we ask people when they're on Zoom is, what's your jitter?
Yeah.
Because it's the worst thing for phone conversations, mm-hmm. for video conversations. Yeah. And I'm really happy to have Micah Sargent. He's stuck around from Ask the Tech Guys.
Hello, hello.
He's in studio. His sweater is not made of seaweed, however.
No, mine is not seaweed. Mine is something else.
Mine is seaweed, if anybody wants to touch me later on.
This is why we don't have live studio audiences anymore, Leo.
Because they will. And we do. We welcome a wonderful studio audience of Club TWiT members. Thank you all for coming and being here. We really appreciate it. It's so nice to see you all. Lisa's very kindly decided to come in on her day off to shepherd people here. Among the celebrities in the studio audience, our famous Joe from the Club TWiT Discord. He's the guy who makes those crazy stickers on This Week in Google. He'll be doing live stickeropathy, whatever you call it. Also, thank you to Greg, who has he's a potter, Earth and Fire Pottery in Northern California, earthandfirepottery.net, who brought us some beautiful, beautiful mugs of his own crafting. Thank you. It's nice to have you. And all the rest of you, welcome. Good to have people. Who's here from the farthest away? Anybody here from England? Okay, never mind. They're all from roughly Northern California, right? Yeah, all right. Story time. I don't know where to begin. I always have some fun. And Micah, you can help me on this. I don't know if this is going to be real or not, okay. But I was grabbed by the headline from the Washington Post, House Senate Leaders Nearing deal on landmark online privacy bill. I never thought I'd live to see it. Is there any chance I will live to see it? I guess would be the next question.
I still don't feel like we're going to live to see it until it actually happens.
The leaders of, it's bipartisan, right? Mm-hmm. Leaders of two key congressional committees, according to the Post, are nearing an agreement on a national framework aimed at protecting Americans' personal data online. Now, if you keep reading, you might see the reason for this. Mm-hmm. It would supersede all the state data protection laws.
Oh.
We have one in California that's quite good, the CCPA. Mm-hmm. It would supersede that.
Yeah, that's that's the biggest source of the conflict, isn't it? That the Republicans are saying supersession is a condition, and the Democrats are saying, no, no, states should be allowed to go above and beyond on privacy. The same way you might argue that states are allowed to decide whether or not marijuana is legal or...
It feels to me like lobbyists for Meta and Google and all the many hundreds of data brokers went up to the Hill and said, you know, what would be great?
Yeah.
We'll work on something. Meta's been saying this for a long time. You know, we need to be regulated. It'd be good to regulate us. Jeff Jarvis calls that regulatory capture when an incumbent supports regulation that they can survive because they're already big and strong and powerful. But any competitor would be dead, at birth. So Meta's been saying, you've probably seen the ads. Oh, regulate us. We need to have privacy laws. And I wouldn't be surprised if all of these people are saying to the Hill, make a law. And by the way, you should supersede those terrible state laws with something that we can live with. The other thing I don't like about it, although I'm thrilled that they're doing it, and I hope they continue to, is that it would, that the enforcement, and this has happened with some laws in Texas, I think, in Florida, would be by us, individuals, who then could sue for bad actors violating our privacy rights. And that, to me, is a problem. Am I wrong, you think? Having individuals sue to enforce a law instead of having regulators regulate?
Or you don't want them to think of it as a cost of business, that they violate your privacy and try to get away with it and deal with
lawsuits. Well, that's how companies have been dealing with security threats for years and years.
It's just a cost of doing business.
It is. They're like, we would rather pay out tiny settlements to people when their data has been breached than have to put in the money for an infrastructure that actually keeps data secure. They ran the numbers and figured it was cheaper. And this type of thing where, oh, you will have to sue to prove that we misused your data. Good luck with that. We're a massive company. You are not. It's not great news for the consumer.
The feds have tried and failed to do this for 20 years.
Yeah.
And as a result of their continual inability to do this, a dozen states have their own strong, in some cases, privacy laws. Illinois has very strong privacy laws. California does.
I thought Utah had really good ones, too.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. I've always said we'll never see a national federal Eddie Snooper law, because I think that the defense and the law enforcement agencies in the United States go to Congress to say, please keep those data brokers going. We're using them. NSA has admitted it. We use them for information. That's where we get a lot of our information. It saves us the trouble of going to Apple and Google and saying, hey, hand over the data. We just buy it from the data brokers who have it anyway. So I'm sure there's intense lobbying from law enforcement not to pass this.
What do you think's changed that there's suddenly more of a, is it that there's more of a public understanding of just how valuable this information
I
is?
I hope like, so.
Where's this coming from that we are more heavily focused on this?
Which company is trying to get ahead of this, I guess, is my question.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're looking at regulations that, or rather, you're looking at proposed legislation that was probably written with some very considered contributions from big companies. And if they put together the regulation now, this protects them later when a story comes out that says, oh, and by the way, they've been packaging and selling your data in tranches to bad actors A through D. Or
it's a lot easier to say, let's go after China and TikTok than actually have comprehensive privacy passed.
Yeah.
But maybe this is the time. I hope so.
I do think also it's notable to take a look at the states that have enacted privacy laws, and a lot of them do business internationally. And
interesting.
Margrethe Vestager in the EU doesn't play. And the EU has had comprehensive data privacy laws, including the right to be forgotten, for 6 years.
GDPR, yeah.
Yeah. So all of the states that did pass these privacy laws, like CCPA, it's good for citizens, but more importantly, it was very good for business. And I think that's going to be something...
It's good for business.
I think that's something you're going... It's easier to do business in the EU if you're like, look, we have the same standards. We don't have to maintain parallel parallel systems for the Wild West of the U.S. and the
well, that's what Apple wants to do, isn't it? Apple.
And having 50 states and potentially 50 different laws does sound like kind of a nightmare.
It is. It is a nightmare. So on that level, you can make an argument that, yes, you should have a federal regulation that supersedes. That said, I don't think it should be devolved down to the lowest common thing.
Exactly. That's the thing. I understand the overall idea of saying, across these 50 states, you know, we're going to put in place this policy. But that, it shouldn't negate the stronger protections that we have here in California, for example.
Here from IAPP.org, which follows this, is a map of U.S. state privacy legislation. The green states have already passed comprehensive privacy bills, but you can see there are a lot of light blue states which are where the bills are in committee, dark blue where they're in cross committee. So
Virginia is ground zero for military data. Like, this is where the data centers are.
Oh, interesting.
This is where Amazon builds out their stuff that they're doing for the military. There's another data farm that's about to go in Western Prince William County. Texas has the same thing with NASA, with military, and with all of the companies that start in California and then open up things like that. We can talk about California.
It's interesting. Washington State does not have any plans.
Maria Cantwell, man.
She's the senator going for the she's the sponsor of the national bill. Yeah. So maybe you know, I'm sure Microsoft has some impact up there. Is it better to have a federal law? I guess it is. You're saying it's better because you know what the rules of the road are. Even if it's from the point of view of Meta or Google draconian, it would be better to have a federal law.
Rather than piecemeal trying to decide how we play in this state, how we play in that state.
I don't think we should be passing legislation based on how Meta's feelings get hurt.
No, I know, I know. Although, you know, in this country, it might be important.
They're as much a citizen as I am, but that doesn't mean that they're rights.
I certainly worry about legislation that's trying to be helpful, screwing things up worse. But on the other hand, the California law has not had any negative impact on my life. I mean, the European laws have probably had slightly more negative impact in terms of stuff like cookie warnings coming around and irritating me.
It also makes me nervous. I'm somebody who runs a website, and we have a club that people sign into. Yeah. I'm always thinking about, am I going to get dinged by GDPR?
Right. I have teeny tiny sites, and I get messages saying you've got to get these privacy things.
Or if you send out an email, this is another thing to consider, too, is there are countries that still go above and beyond the EU. For example, Germany has more stringent privacy regulations above and beyond the EU for some understandable reasons. Australia has really great privacy regulations. So if you're somebody who runs an international mailing list, you're already worried about this. And it's just a thing where, like you say, it's like a low grade level of friction where you have to be aware. Okay, if I have Germans on my Substack,
honestly,
I need to make sure I'm not violating their rights.
Ecosystem of bottom feeders who are sending emails to you and me, Harry, and probably to you, Lisa, saying, you know, you really need to adjust your, you know, cookie warning, or you're going to be in trouble. I don't even know how
enforceable
or real these are. There was a really interesting piece a couple of weeks ago by a guy who said, you know, all those cookie warnings, you don't have to do that.
It was just sort of
good, because I haven't in most cases.
It just seemed like it was the thing to do.
There was one site, I can't remember what it is now, but I could not access the site at all. And I even went into the HTML and was trying to set hidden to some of the properties to get it gone. And there was layer upon layer upon layer of these windows that they had put in front of it. And this was like a health site. So there was no way to, I think it was like an insurance thing or whatever. And so they were very serious about making sure you said, I am okay with these cookies, but not these cookies. It was very frustrating.
I don't know who this is, if this guy's a attorney or not. It's the Bytecode blog at bytecode.dev. Yeah. There is no, he says, EU cookie banner law. You know those modal screens that interrupt your groove when you're surfing? There are no laws forcing websites to use them. They do it because they choose to. He says American companies don't have to comply with EU law. And in fact, even if you think people from the EU are going to visit your website, you don't have to show it, which explains why Amazon does not have a cookie banner, does it?
I have a site with some Google ads on it And Google is very interested in me complying with all this stuff and reminds me to do it. And in some cases, lets me have Google put the warnings on my site.
He says that really what's really going on is that nobody, there is a do not track setting in your browser, in all your browsers, which we've said many times. Steve Gibson's always saying it does nothing.
Right.
Because sites ignore it. So much so that it's deprecated now. But really, that would be the thing to do, according to Bytecode. He says if you would just honor the do not track, you wouldn't have to do that. In fact, furthermore, he says he believes cookie banners are illegal.
Okay, who is this person again, by the way? Is this somebody who plays a lawyer on TV?
That's a good question. I don't know, but he makes a pretty strong case. So,
Your Honor, he makes a pretty strong case.
I read a blog once, and he said I didn't have to do this. This is why you end up doing it.
I kind of want this to be a show on NBC now.
Yeah.
I read a blog once.
I read a blog that said, by the way, I don't have to pay taxes either. Did I mention that?
I heard that.
Yeah.
You're a sovereign citizen.
Yeah, I'm a sovereign citizen.
Of Leoville.
Well, anyway, I consult your local authorities, but I think he makes a strong case that the cookie banner thing, it's just easier to do it than not to do it.
And I think that's what it is, yeah.
But really, if we cared about privacy, there are better things to do, like honor, do not track.
And there's so many, what are those sort of software as a service platforms out there whose specific purpose is to, you just put this line of JavaScript and then suddenly you're cookie protected. And
your cookie problems are gone.
Yeah, exactly. They're all there to make sure that all of it is covered.
We get those emails, right, Lisa? And we've gone through and you need a comprehensive privacy policy. Okay. Even though on our main website, twit.tv, there's no login.
Right.
Nobody... There's no. It's very frustrating. It's hard to know as a small business owner, and I am pretty small. as he shrinks down in his seat, that what to do about that stuff. But I just put one on,
and that's why, right? Because it's so hard to know what you have to do.
Right.
That you just do as much as you can to cover yourself, cover all your bases.
I have a passive aggressive cookie banner on my personal blog that says, I can't show it because I've already agreed to it. But if you go to leo.fm, you see it says at the bottom something like, oh. Yeah, this site has cookies. What about it?
This site uses a cookie to remember your light dark mode. That's what I'm getting.
That's the only cookie I set.
Learn more.
For light dark mode. And then I do have to learn more because I think that's kind of people want that. What are cookies? Blah, blah, blah. Cookies are not inherently problematic, period. But Google is so aware of it that they've created a new technology that's, we'll talk about that sometime. Steve's talked about it a lot, that eliminates third-party cookies in favor of your own browser spying on you, which is a better thing to do. It's the malicious compliance cookie banner, Joe, if you want to make me a sticker. By the way, Joe Esposito, who is in our studio audience today, has already made his first sticker of the day. Right after you had explained what jitter is to me, Lisa Schmeiser smiling through the 10th time explaining jitter.
I love that. That is delightful.
The sticker man is in the house, ladies and gentlemen. More coming up in just a bit. But first, a word from our sponsor, Collide, K-O-L-I-D-E. You've heard us talk about Collide before, but have you heard? This is good news. Collide was just acquired by 1Password. Now, that's a big deal. Both companies lead the industry in creating security solutions that put users first. For over a year, Collide Device Trust has helped companies with Okta ensure that only known and secure devices can access their data. And they're still doing it. Absolutely. But they're now doing it with the added resources and support of 1Password. So, if you have Okta and you've been meaning to check out Collide, now is a great time. Collide comes with a library of pre-built device posture checks, but you can also write your own custom checks to protect you from just about anything you can think of. Plus, you can use Collide on laptops without MDM. That means your Linux fleet, your contractor devices, every BYOD phone and laptop in your company, and you know there are plenty of those. Now that Collide is part of 1Password, it's just going to get better. So check it out, Collide, KOLIDE.com/Twit to learn more. Watch the demo today. KOLIDE.com/twit. And we thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. Lisa Schmeiser is here from nojitter.com. Harry McCracken, the technologizer from Fast Company. And it's nice to have you in studio, Micah. I think I've heard of you from time to time.
Well, I've heard of you, too.
I've heard of you. Mike and I do a really good show on the TWiT Network called Ask the Tech Guys. It's fun this morning.
We
talking
did.
About the eclipse. I guess you're all here. You're not going to see the eclipse. No.
No.
My sister is in Texas, and I assume has plans.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a very... Anybody here planning to fly out tonight? Jason Snell is flying mm-hmm. to... Where's he going?
I'm not sure. Where.
Mexico?
Somewhere.
I think distant, at least Texas.
Yeah. David Pogue says he's going to Vermont.
That's easy for David. I think he lives near there.
This is probably explaining. I got crazy great last minute tickets to Hawaii for tomorrow. And I'm pretty sure.
Are you going to Hawaii?
I'm going to the Big Island tomorrow. And I'm pretty sure the reason everything was so cheap is because Hawaii is like on the exact opposite side of where the eclipse is.
So. Oh, it is cheap right now, isn't it?
I'm going to Hawaii tomorrow. Let me just.
Yeah, let's all go to Hawaii. I don't want to scare you, Lisa. We were talking earlier to Johnny Jett, who is the travel guru on our Ask the Tech Guys show.
He's going to scare you.
I'm going to scare you just in case.
Yeah.
And he was on, he just flew to Oahu.
Yeah.
He was on an American Airlines plane to Hawaii. He's sitting in the back there, and the pilot comes on and says this.
There was the aircraft is being observed, so to speak, because oil pressure on the number two engine is trending upwards. And the aircraft is going to require, it's the fuel pressure. Fuel system filter replacement when the aircraft gets back from Hawaii. They told us that the plane's good to go, but I'm not really feeling it. I'm not going to leave the ground if I'm not completely certain that we have an airworthy aircraft, so I'm going to probably err on the side of caution, and I'm refusing the aircraft. So
they
had
to get off and get another flight.
We have another
but listen
here
to the reaction from the audience, the passengers, when the pilot says, I don't think we're flying this plane. And remember, these guys have to get off, find another plane. Oh, don't take it away, because they applaud.
Things stand now. I apologize for that. Morning hasn't been so good.
They actually applaud his choice. And you know what? If I were a passenger,
I would too.
I would too. You don't think it's safe?
Because you have a pilot. Bear in mind, he's put all this stuff on the news about how Boeing is like, things fall off planes. Who cares?
Yeah.
So it's nice to have a pilot who's like,
going to hit the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if he says, let's not.
Because it's somebody in the whole aviation system that's advocating for the safety of the passengers. And we have had nothing but news stories lately about how Boeing is blithely like, meh, doors, they fall off. Who cares?
They do.
Micah said something interesting when
we talked about it this morning.
Uh-huh.
You said,
are we talking about the hope thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do we have other than the hope that we will get a pilot who makes that choice? Because how many times have we been on a flight and we don't know?
We don't know if the pilot's
been told that.
Yeah.
And the pilot decides, you know what? We're still flying because the company's telling me to fly.
I want to fly.
That's kind of scary.
Yeah.
That's the last line of defense, but it's a thin gray line.
You just have to hope you get a pilot who says, you know what?
Anyway, have a nice trip.
Like I said, great tickets, because I feel like it's, you know, again, on the opposite
side. Lisa, can we go to Hawaii tomorrow? Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's get out of here.
Big Island, man. Yeah.
Maybe there'll be some sunshine there.
Oh.
Not for Marissa Meyer.
Oh. Very clever.
Nice
that was
segue.
Good.
Marissa Meyer, the former VP at Google. We all knew and loved her, right? She was the product manager.
I wrote a cover story about her.
Did you?
Yeah. For Fast Company? Or?
Mm-hmm.
She was the person famous for the Google search page, for keeping it simple, who obsessed about, you know, the perfect design for it. Left Google to become CEO at Yahoo when Yahoo was in desperate straits.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she thought, and a lot of people thought, white knight riding in, she's going to save Yahoo. She was not able to do that. So she left Yahoo and founded a startup studio, which at the time was called, I think, Lumi, is now called, is it Sunshine? And just released an app March 27th and was immediately mocked. Somebody, she released it. I don't know if she publicized it any other way besides on Twitter. That might have been the first mistake. Did she send out an email?
Yeah, because I got it twice for some reason.
Okay.
Wow.
Somebody said this looks like it was designed in 1996, you know, by a Latvian, postcard company. It's not the most attractive thing in the world. And even though there were high hopes for this, in fact, in the office, this is from Platformer.
Wow.
Zoe Schiffer and Casey Newton writing this. In the office, they have great inside sources. So in the office, employees placed bets on how many downloads the app would get on its first day. Myers set hers high at 12,000 because 12 is her lucky number. Yeah. Platformer has learned the actual number of downloads day one, 1,000.
Oh.
1,000. Shortly after it was released, Myers co-founder at Sunshine, former Google and Yahoo executive Enrique Munoz Torres resigned. He quit. And as usual with Platformer, they've got kind of some inside insight as to what went on there. Apparently, Meyer was very hands-on.
Very hands-on.
This is the same woman who agonized over the specific color of purple and the specific cast of the Y when they were redesigning the Yahoo logo. Do you remember that? And she had the whole blog post
explaining. The exclamation point had to be at exactly the right angle.
Yeah, yeah. They spent a weekend.
What I loved about it is reportedly, she went on a vacation with friends, and of course her friends, mm-hmm. who are they actually her friends or are they just hanging out with a rich lady?
Maybe they're colleagues.
Exactly. They were all hanging out. The friend was using Shine because of course you've got to use your friend's app, and it ended up posting some images that were selfies that the person had taken. And so that person did not like that it had posted in the group conversation, mm-hmm. and was embarrassed that it showed up. So Marissa Meyer came back after their vacation and was immediately like, by the way, if a photo is taken with the front-facing camera and there's only one person inside of it, that should not show up in the app. So it just became, these are the experiences that I am having, and that's how we should make this app that's available to all of these people.
Well, and you remember, I'm sure I know, Harry, you would color.
I remember color. I mean, the
same idea, right? Yeah. That it would know where you are. Shine's plan was it would know where you are and then would create a photo, joint photo album of everybody else who was around you.
It's so great that, like, no one has privacy. Like, it's, that's the whole thing. It's basically an app where it's like everyone will know what you're doing and where you are and who you're with at all times. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that is totally fine with
you. It's like contact tracing turned into a photo app.
I think I was talking about this with Lisa before the show too, is what problem did this solve? Like, what pent up demand or irritation about taking photos and sharing them with people? Like, what unmet need did this address?
Right, because all of the photo sharing apps that I know and use, Google Photos, Apple Photos, even Amazon, I'm sure, mm-hmm. have this built-in opportunity to create a shared library with other people.
Yeah.
It's already done. So to make it, and then as you said, make it look like it was made in years ago, it was a little bit odd. But I mean, I don't know. I had high hopes for the other Sunshine apps, the Contacts.
They had a Contacts app, which has also struggled. Even though I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
There were problems early on of it duplicating it was supposed to deduplicate your contacts, but in fact duplicating your contacts. Some of the I guess, you know, you'd expect this on Twitter. Some of the tweets in response to her announcement were pretty nasty. One tweeter said, Marissa, you've hurt the reputation of Stanford more than SBF's parents.
Oh. I have to say I'm a little more sympathetic.
Wait, there's Elizabeth Holmes. Don't let Elizabeth Holmes off on this one.
Is this a parody? Why is the UX from 2002?
Retro.
That's her other favorite number.
Go ahead,
Jerry. I have to say this is an idea that keeps coming back. Even before there was color, there was something called Cool Iris, which also did similar stuff. That, I mean, the notion of like zero friction photo sharing has always been out there and has never caught on, probably partially because it has some basic challenges as an idea. And I believe that the idea here is that these photos are not going out to random strangers. They're at least going out to people who we're also at your party or whatever. I do personally find that when trying to share photos with friends or family members, I sometimes just forget to do it. And so I'm at least vaguely intrigued by the idea
sort of solves
of something that would intelligently do it. I think there's also this other basic problem that it's very hard to be a photo app, given that all devices have built-in photo apps and stuff like Instagram already exists. So even if it's wonderful, the bar is very high. But it is something that is fundamentally super challenging.
Just in case you're confused, that is not Yahoo Purple. That is four digits off Yahoo Purple in the hex color
scheme. Thank goodness. Yeah. I was worried.
I did try this app.
I did. I downloaded immediately. I was one of the 1,000.
I think I was too.
I plugged it on MacBreak Weekly.
I plugged it in my phone and I left the app open purposely so it could do all of its processing because I thought, oh, surely it's going to get better. And I came back hours later and it still looked the same. And I thought, I don't want to share any of the things that because it was supposed to use AI, right? The whole thing about Sunshine, the company, we made clever uses of AI, and also their company culture is be nice or leave.
Really?
Yeah,
that's the slogan? That's,
yeah, be nice or leave.
Oh my God, it's like the weaponized be kind.
Yeah, and so don't be evil. But I was waiting for the clever AI to kick in, and it was just locations.
It's all
and in almost every single one of my photos, there was no one in any of the photos. So who was I supposed to be? Oh yes, that little tiny gecko I should probably share with that gecko that's in this photo.
It did make an album of all the pictures I took of you when we unboxed the Vision Pro.
Here's
but those were all taken like right at the same
time. They were all taken at the same time. Well, I had the address right on it.
So one of the innate challenges in photo sharing apps or photo sharing in a social setting period is different people are going to have different tolerances for privacy.
Yes.
I'm just going to throw this use case out there. Say you're throwing a children's birthday party and you've got 10 little girls and it's a really cute photo album. It's on you as the person throwing the party, though. You have to reach out to all those families and go, hey, if I put up a photo album on Facebook, is that cool? Mm-hmm. Or if I put this up on Google Photos with a password, are you okay with me sharing pictures of your kids? And that's the kind of problem you could, in theory, use technology to solve. I don't see how this app could do something like that, though, where it could reach out to the people in the albums and go, hey, your kid's in an album. Is that cool?
And wait for the checkbox to come in, essentially. The consent is there, right?
Yeah.
That would be neat.
Yeah.
But I don't, I have to say.
Or maybe there's people who just don't like having their social life on.
Yes.
Like, I'm sure I'm not the only person this has happened to where I've gone over to a friend's house for a get-together. The friend has put up group photos on Facebook, which has let other people know they weren't invited to the shindig. Like, that's the kind of problem that technology can simultaneously create and or solve. Mm-hmm. And something like Shine, I could see where they're like, look, it's just a very small group of people. You're bypassing some of the awkwardness, but you're also introducing new levels of awkwardness around consent.
Yep. Yeah. And, well, not ever. That's the thing. I wish that more people thought like that, because I can tell you there are going to be lots of people who would not consider reaching out to all 10 of those people and asking if their kids can be posted. And this is, in theory, running things through some AI system. Are you okay with your, you know,
kid being part of the data set?
Yeah. That's something to consider.
Is the AI actually capable of identifying adults versus children in photos?
Yeah, I mean, it's not entirely clear whether AI solves some of these issues or creates new issues.
Yeah.
There's a good app called Tiny Beans, which is basically designed for incredibly private sharing of photos involving kids. And as far as I know, there's no AI involved. It's it's you deciding what's appropriate. And it's all private. Yeah. So it removes a lot of the challenges.
Yeah, I mean, if you spend any time on any of the subreddits where people are like, am I the jerkwad in this situation? Like, at least once a month, somebody is posting something because some relative of theirs is splashing their kid across social media. They asked them to stop, and World War III erupted. And it's kind of baffling to me that in the year 2024, when we all have access to these lurid Reddit soap operas, and or we all have access to phones with cameras, you don't have product managers and developers who are like, okay, we know that there's a potential for conflict around sharing photos here. What governors are we putting into our product to make sure that we're not inflaming the situation, or we're allowing an elegant solution to the situation?
So at least they have a sense of humor after the... This was March 26th, after the brutal comments by quote, design Twitter. Sunshine posted on April 1st, "We all heard you loud and clear," and showed an even more brutal design of Shine. Obviously, an April Fool's joke. I want it to succeed. Yeah. I like the idea. I feel bad for Marissa Meyer.
Second acts are always nice to see.
It's so hard, though, isn't it, to have a second act?
Or I guess maybe a third act in this case.
Yeah. But is she actually embarking on an act that speaks to her strengths?
Well, they got the purple right.
She certainly, I think, did have a sizable impact on Google in the early days, which worked out well for everybody involved in terms of what it was. Although, Google is now, 25 years old, and it's interesting to wonder, would it work as well if that homepage was launched today?
Yeah.
And the homepage doesn't look all that much like it did originally, because they're way more willing to clutter it up than they were back in those days.
Yeah.
A little bit in the story, and of course, Casey Newton and Zoe Shaver have been writing about Elon Musk. And in fact, she's got a book about the Twitter revolution. It does feel a little bit like another CEO who kind of runs by a company by fiat, like Elon does. Didn't it feel like an Elon?
Well, this is a very small team, too. That helps.
It's only 15 people, right? They said, they noted that while Marissa uses Monday, former sponsor, Monday.com, to keep track of everything, no one else does. So they have a whiteboard they call Analog Monday in the office so that people
Analog
can see.
Monday.
Analog,
so great band name.
That's actually a really interesting.
That's a good name.
It's a really interesting insight, though, because you've already got, you're duplicating a process. Either because the CEO is unwilling to say, this is the tool that we're all using, let's get our information and our processes in one place, or the people like, no, this Monday.com is terrible. I'm not saying it is, because I'm sure that Monday.com works wonderfully for
people. No, it's great, actually.
But the fact that you don't have a formalized process structure in place, and what you've done instead is duplicate the CEO's idiosyncratic process for people who haven't bought into that, that's a problem.
But that's, I feel like that's very common. People are always going to manage up with with the person who's in charge and will bend to the will of who's in charge.
Then get especially on Monday.com.
I see what you're saying. You're saying instead of holding out on joining Monday, why not just join Monday?
Or why not have her say, this is what we're using. I like it, we're using it.
Yeah.
I
mean, that's a good point. Yeah.
Like, why isn't she doing
play
that?
Ball,
it sounds like she's got a fairly recalcitrant team working for
there are tons of studies that talk about how much time workers waste in information capture and information retrieval. Like close to 20% of your work week is spent just trying to find the information you need to do your job.
I spent 20% of my time just trying to choose what to wear for the show.
Leo, you just need five of those jackets. Make it a uniform.
It is the right purple. I might add, it is a perfect.
But purple. What I'm saying is, if you've got somebody who's running a company where she has made it acceptable to introduce a whole new level of information capture issues. Like,
that's
why?
Not good.
That's entirely
that's the
preventable.
Wrong direction.
Why? Good point.
You're the CEO. Just say, no, this is how we're doing it. This is what we're using to capture information, to track our projects, and to make sure everybody knows everything at the same time. This Analog Monday thing isn't cute. It's a failure of leadership.
Oh, wow.
Woo! Incidentally, if anybody would like to read more about Marissa Meyer and the color purple, I wrote what I consider to be the definitive article on that topic some years ago for Fast Company. And if you Google for that, you'll probably find it. I spoke to her at surprisingly length about the color.
Tell me about her. Did you like her?
That's what I wrote on. I think she's a really smart person. I do think she is a little bit under the spotlight, and maybe not by anybody on this panel, but maybe occasionally is somewhat fairly drubbed for things that if she were Matthew Meyer, she might get away with a little more easily.
And that's sad if that's true, but I believe it.
Well, reminds me
of actually wrote about
I wrote about
Sunshine
the Contacts
when it first
app too.
Came out.
And before that, I wrote about her when she was at Yahoo, and she spent so much time talking about purple, I wrote a separate story about it. she wanted to make clear that purple is not her favorite color. Her favorite color is yellow, but purple is her mother's favorite color, and so it also matters to her.
Aww.
Well, in a way, it kind of reminds me of Kim Pelosi. which was a story.
Oh, Kim Polezzi.
Yeah, 1996.
She was a product manager for Java.
And then she launched Marimba.
Marimba, yes.
She was like super hyped. And when that didn't work out, there was a whole lot of meep, meep, meep about
that. Because
she
was a woman.
Yeah, exactly. Well, she was hyped for being a woman. And then she was meep, meep, meep. Of course, she can't make it work because, and so I agree with you.
That's a very good point. I remember Kim very well. Always, I really
it's
liked
the same
her.
Thing with Sheryl Sandberg, too. You always get these women who are held up as...
Lean in so we could punch you.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know,
that's a good show title. Lean in so we can punch
that
you.
That is actually the story of pop culture in America, which is we love to build up people so we can shoot them down, men or women, right? I mean, Behind the Music, baby. Did you grow up watching Behind the Music on MTV?
No.
Oh, it was VH1.
VH1. Sorry, you did. You're the one who did.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Because it was always the same story arc, right?
Yeah.
Band gets huge. Band gets big. Band collapses and drugs overdose and then
like
comes
a
back.
They did a series on Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, wow.
You kind of had to, though, because it was Fleetwood Mac. But
yeah, I just was reading about all the drama there. Yeah. And anyway,
I can't believe, Harry, that you wrote an entire article on Marissa
Myers. She gave
Myers
me so much good material.
Love affair with the color purple.
It used to kind of torment her that people assumed she loved purple, and so they would give her purple stuff. And
oh, that's so awkward. Poor woman.
And then also, people mistakenly believed that she loved cupcakes, which was an urban legend, and so they would give her purple cupcakes.
God, the nightmare. Oh, my God.
But, you know, the Beatles did the same thing. Remember, they did an interview where they said they loved jelly beans or whatever they call them in England, and they would get pelted from the on the stage with jelly beans?
Okay, so hold on. If I say I love basketballs, they're going to throw basketballs.
That's right. Don't. Whatever you do.
Or if you love money.
Yeah, there we go. But not quarters.
Oh, yeah, I love money. Soft money, paper money. Yeah. I love it. Just throw it at me.
Let's fold it up like a paper airplane.
The Yahoo logo was originally red, which I forgot about until I wrote this story.
Oh, yeah, look at that.
Oh, yeah.
But
it was,
you know what? To her credit, purple really did become its color. I mean, I told the story on Mac Break Weekly. Lisa had season tickets to the 49ers in the Yahoo section. And we had to go up to go see the game at Levi Stadium. A purple escalator was lit like a nightclub purple. And every 10 feet, it would go, Yahoo! Oh. It was so annoying. You remember that, Lisa? Am I making that up? No, it would do that. It was so annoying.
Purple was Yahoo's color when she got there, but she changed it to a different purple. And she made it more consistent. Yeah. And there's this long story about why they chose purple, and there's more than one version of it, but all the versions involved them buying some cheap purple paint in the early days of the company and painting the walls purple just because the paint was cheap.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I love it when that's the reason behind stuff.
Oh, I just remember that. Do you guys remember the Yahoo sign that used to be in South of Market, the pretty neon sign?
Yes.
That was the best billboard ever.
Oh, it was fantastic.
It was right off Highway 101 as you're driving through the city of San Francisco.
And it's South of Market,
And it was not just neon. It was like three-dimensional. It was
like an old hotel sign.
Yeah, it's a nice place to stay on the internet, they called it. Oh, my gosh.
Let me see if I can.
I wonder if that sign still exists somewhere.
It was a sad day, and I remember it vividly when they took it down.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, it is like a motel sign.
It was so cute.
Yeah.
Kind of like a Holiday Inn sign.
It's kind of sad. What happened to Yahoo?
They're still around.
They're actually a...
My mom uses them. My mom uses them as a news aggregator. And when I was working actually at a business newspaper, finance.yahoo.com was kind of our in-house tool.
I still use it.
It was a great way to look up stock news. It was a great way to keep track of different ticker symbols.
Yep. When I show ticker symbols on this show, I almost always use Yahoo Finance for some reason.
There probably aren't all that many companies that employ more journalists on the internet than Yahoo does to this day. I don't know the exact number, but I do know it's still a large operation with a lot of eyeballs, and some of the people there are really good.
Yahoo.
Nobody ever talks about it, but they do go there.
Yeah, it's just that sexy.
Where are
you
right now?
The My Yahoo page is still there. That was my homepage for a long time. It knows where I live, apparently.
Yahoo Mail still has lots of people using it.
Oh, my mom uses it.
That's the one thing where anytime somebody's got Yahoo Mail, let's get you somewhere safer.
This isn't a good neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, little break. I want to talk about Elon Musk, the Tesla stock tanking, but Musk found a way to boost it. He found a way to boost it. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Harry McCracken is here, the Technologizer. I still call you that. I hope you don't
mind. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Do you still have the Technologizer blog?
I blog there occasionally. Yeah. I'm not.
Keep it alive, you know?
Not every week or maybe not even every month, but sometimes.
Yeah.
And I recently...
to have a hobby.
I took it off of WordPress and I kind of freeze-dried it so it can stay up essentially forever. It was still based on a template from 2008, which was not compatible with modern versions of PHP. And so I managed to figure out how to like crunch it all down. And
can you help me freeze-dry my blog?
Mm-hmm. I can show you how I did it.
Freeze-dry mine. Then can you, do you add water and it... leaps.
Yeah, it's like I could even put it on a thumb drive and it would operate from a thumb drive.
That's cool.
Which is not true.
Standalone.
True of a WordPress blog.
Yeah, so, no, that's cool.
So as long as I pay my hosting fee, it'll be up forever.
Yay. Lisa Schmeiser is here, nojitter.com. What is that thing again? Jitter? What is, no, don't tell me. Don't tell me. I don't want to know. And we're so glad that Micah Sargent, you've been on Twit before.
Yeah. I've hosted it before.
That's right. But it's kind of nice to have you
as a guest.
I think you should be on every show, personally. I've been saying that for a while now.
The kindest thing you say to me regularly.
I just don't want to. I want you to host it. Keep coming, and maybe you will someday. Micah does all about nothing. He does
Tech News iOS, Weekly,
that's
iOS
right.
Today.
iOS Today. And a hands-on Macintosh, which is now in public, by the way. Thanks. To our esteemed CEO who's decided that all of the shows that used to be behind the Club Twit paywall are now available audio only to the public. That includes iOS Today, Home Theater Geeks, Hands on Macintosh, Hands on Windows, the Untitled Linux Show. They're all available as audio shows to the public. So subscribe if you haven't. And, of course, if you join the club, you get the video versions of it, which I think is a... We want to give you something when you join the club. Club Twit is $7 a month, which I think is about as inexpensive as it could be, given the number of shows you get. Ad-free versions of all the shows, not just the ones I mentioned, but Twit, MacBreak Weekly, This Week in Space, and, you know, I can go on and on. Get all of those shows ad-free, Windows Weekly, This Week in Google. You also get Twit Plus stuff that we don't put out anywhere else, like our book club with Stacey that's coming up. In just a little bit, the Inside Twit, Lisa and I just did, and access to the Club Twit Discord, where Joe Esposito will post stickers and other things. He's working on them right now. He's in the back of the studio working on some more stickers for the Discord. Look, the real reason you join, it makes a big difference into what we can do going forward. Ad support for so many podcasts has disappeared. We don't want to be one of those podcasts that falls off the face of the earth. With your help, we don't have to be. I like your new sticker, Joe. twit.tv/clubtwit. And thank you for your support. Why can't I? This sticker is from the server. You can use it everywhere. Oh, you made this the sticker we can all use. Thank you. Leo Laporte, Blue Sky Hype Influencer. That's me.
Those aren't your legs, though, right? That's just you slouching, and then the rest has been added by Joe.
Joe, are those somebody else's thighs you put on me?
They're
AI generated. They're rather large. They look like small hams attached to my pelvis.
Jamon.
Jamon. Somebody's saying it's like Succession. I'm just going to keep leading you on, Micah.
I've never watched Succession, so I thought it was a positive thing. I guess not.
No, it's not. Our show today brought to you by Bitwarden. We love our Bitwarden, the password manager, the only open source password manager you can use at home, at work, everywhere, on every device you've got, and free forever for personal use. That's Bitwarden. I know you, because you listen to the show, you're smart, you're tech sophisticate. I'm sure you use a password manager. But if you don't, Bitwarden is the only one I would consider. It is a cost-effective solution that will dramatically improve your chances of staying safe online. Bitwarden has, because it's open source, always been adding new features. They recently added inline autofill, which I have been loving. I added that to Arc, and man, I have like the best browser ever. It's easier than ever to log into websites. When you click a username or password field, a drop down shows up showing you what your password choices are. You click it, you're logged in, it's fast. They support passkeys too now. I'm converting all my passkeys that were hardware dependent on my iPhone or other devices into Bitwarden, so those passkeys go with me everywhere. Makes it so easy to log in. If you're a current Bitwarden user, you got to turn on the autofill feature. So go to the settings menu in the browser extension, select autofill, use that drop down box to show autofill menu on form fields, and then pick the option that works best for you. It is easily the best password manager I've ever used. Wired says it's best for most people. Harry's own Fast Company said calls it one of the 2023 brands that matter in security. Bitwarden is the open source password manager trusted by millions. And if you have friends and family, this is where it's most important. If you have friends and family who say, I'm not going to use a password manager. And they say, I don't want to pay for a password manager. Tell them about Bitwarden, free for personal use forever on all your devices, as many passwords as you can use. It even supports passkeys on the free personal version. And if you're a business, you got to try it. The Teams or Enterprise plan, you can get a free trial right now if you go to bitwarden.com/twit or get started free across all devices as the individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. You can even host your own. If you don't want to have them do the hosting, which I do, you can even host your own vault wherever you want. I love it. bitwarden.com/twit. Elon is a master. There are a few people in our world today. Donald Trump's one of them. Elon Musk is another, who are masterful at grabbing the headline, right? At changing the conversation. Tesla stock starting to go down severely. So he announces, we're going to have a Tesla robo-taxi August 8th. And what happens to the stock price? Boom. Will they have a robo-taxi product on August 8th? Who knows? That's not the important thing.
This is the man who's been saying since 2015 that self-driving cars are any day now. And
he said, I think 5 years ago, every Tesla owner would be able to turn on this feature that would let other people rent your car when you're not using it, and it would just drive them around. That never happened.
I mean, the thing you should take away from this story is not that, robo-taxis are coming, but rather that the street is desperate to believe that Elon Musk and Tesla are still a good bet.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing, is I'd be looking askance at the street rather than taking this story as factual, period.
In 2016, Elon said, you'll be able to send one of our cars on a cross-country drive all by itself.
Why would you want to?
I don't know, but you could. They've been talking about this autonomous robo-taxi that will turn its cars into level 3 automated vehicles, but it hasn't happened. So, you know.
They've been talking.
They've been talking. He's good at that.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about it.
I feel like this is going to be the theme I keep hammering home during this episode. But when you talk about automatic taxis, what problem are you solving for here? Is it, I don't want to talk to a cabbie? I don't want to talk to my Uber driver?
No, the problem you're solving, certainly when it was Uber's idea, is the cost of a driver, a human driver. That's the
big cost. That's not a problem for the user. The thing is you have to persuade consumers that they want robo-taxis. Like, what problem are you solving for consumers where they're going
to
pick this?
Have you ever ridden in one of those Waymos or lifts or cruises or whatever they were?
No.
Harry, you have. I remember we talked about it.
I've been in a cruise when there were cruises in San Francisco. I saw somebody last week, say they prefer Waymos to Ubers or Lyfts in San Francisco.
Because they don't have to talk to a driver.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you don't love talking to drivers, you might find the privacy of a self-driving car to be appealing. He also claimed that the Waymos are better drivers than human drivers.
They drive like grandmas, though, right? They're very...
I want my grandma driving me places. That's really what I want, because here's...
That's because your grandma's 52.
Well, and also, I don't... That might be true. But I also don't have... To be perfectly
blunt...
If your
grandma were my age, you might not want her to be driving.
I don't have to worry about my grandma being a... Like, to believe that
she's
aliens
careful.
Have probed her. That anti... You know, like, that vaccinations... Like, I have been in so many different...
I'm a sovereign citizen. Stop signs don't apply to me.
Yeah, I've been in so many different Ubers where the person just starts telling me these scary things that I'm like, you live on a different planet, which is cool, but now I'm in this vehicle with you, and I don't want to be on your planet.
The thing is, though, you have, like, a number you can call, or you have a thing. The concern I have about I pop into this pod that takes me from point A to point B is if something goes wrong, who am I talking to?
Well, Well, like, you push a button and then you're talking to the guy
who's actually driving
the car.
There's a level, and this is something where we saw it with self-checkout at stores, where the minute it screws up, you've got to wait for somebody to come and fix it for you. When you remove people from the equation, you're kind of removing an incentive for consumers to get your product because they don't trust you to do right by them.
See, this is the difference between you and me.
Uh-huh.
And I think Micah and you.
Uh-huh.
You like people.
Yeah.
I find people really interesting. I'm not sure that's the same as
That's the difference.
Yeah. Well,
Micah and I don't want to.
I do like people, but my problem is I have trouble setting boundaries. And so the moment I get in that vehicle, I don't care how I feel.
No.
I'm going to talk to you if you want to talk to me. Yeah. And I don't want to talk to you, but because you want to talk, I'm going to talk to you.
I'm
not good at being like, no.
So you've never hopped in and said, hey, I'd rather work right now.
I can't do that.
Uber has a button on the app, though. That's why
I know, and I won't use that button either because it seems mean.
I mean, I once had a cab ride from the Savannah at Georgia Airport at midnight where the cabbie drove me through the Pine Barrens and talked about how easy it was to hide the bodies.
See, that's what I'm saying.
Obviously a Sopranos fan, actually. That's where they...
And I remember, writing down, his number and putting it on a piece of paper and being like, maybe they'll find the number when they find my body.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
But my point is...
I wanted to hide a body...
Practicing your tuck and roll?
My God. No. This was also that I went for...
It's terrifying.
Actually, no, the ride back to the airport was more terrifying because the dude turned down a second fare and then talked about the shotgun he had under his seat. And I was like, I was not aware there were firearms.
You know, the robots won't talk about the shotgun under their seat. So
they'll just have the button that you can press to shoot things. No, but my point is they're with all of these closed loop little automated systems.
No, you make a good
you
point.
Do kind of need some sort of, in case of emergency, to talk to human, press this button.
Yes. Yeah.
Or if you are not happy with this product, here's how you can get it redressed and it's not a customer service bot. And I think with a lot of these products, when you make the effort to cut human beings out of a workforce, you're also significantly degrading the quality of the product for the people using it.
Mm. It's also interesting to see how quickly Cruise just kind of completely collapsed.
No kidding. What happened there?
Well, starting with the fact that they had an ugly incident or two of the
they dragged a pedestrian under their car.
Doing things like that. And then the entire company, I mean, it's not completely gone, but it's out of commission.
They don't want to start up again.
The executives all left, and it's not entirely clear what's going to happen to this enormous investment on GM's part.
Don't you think the real truth is that self-driving vehicles aren't really... We haven't figured level 4 or 5 prepping out.
It seems like largely self-driving vehicles can be a thing, and entirely self-driving vehicles is 100 times harder.
Yeah, Sam Abul Samad, says that he doesn't see it.
He said on this show there will never be a level 5 vehicle, at least not in the next 100 years.
Yeah.
And the other thing, and we were talking about this earlier on Ask the Tech Guys, we're learning more and more about AI, is there is human involvement. There was a lot of human involvement in Cruise.
Amazon Go.
And Go. Let's talk about that,
actually.
I just had
a great interview about that I did with Cisco's Javed Khan at Enterprise Connect, which will be going up on No Jitter shortly. We talked about how Cisco believes that the foundation of great generative AI comes with great transcripts. And I said, so how'd you get that going? How'd that technology happen? And he's like, well, we had an army of human beings transcribing everything until we could get to the point where we could train the AI to do it. They relied on human beings because the technology is just not there yet to be able to train an AI to correctly transcribe something without people doing the first steps.
We learned from documents submitted to NHTSA and the Department of Motor Vehicles that a lot of Cruise and Waymo vehicles had frequent takeovers. The human drivers back at the office would, the car would say, what do I do here? I have no idea what to do. And the human would take over. Now we're learning that Amazon's Just Walk Out tech was very much human driven. That's why Amazon is dropping it. Go ahead.
They claim they have something that's better, which I think involves shopping carts where you can scan the stuff as you go.
Is that better?
Why do we? Why does this? Why
that makes me do the work?
Who wants this?
But but
better for them. Maybe.
But it might also, until I read that stuff, I was not aware of how many human beings there were watching the cameras in the Amazon Go stores and watching what I plucked off the shelf.
Yeah.
They said that a great percentage, I think it was up to 90% of all of the walk-out customers had to be, the video had to be examined by a human. They had more than 1,000 employees to verify that what we're charging them for is actually what they just walked out with. And you could see that that's not very tenable. And Amazon has decided to can that. They're no longer going to build stores with just walk out. They're going to have the carts where you scan it. At the same time, stores like Target and Walmart are phasing out their self-checkout because I know every time I use a self-checkout, somebody has to come over and help me.
And if you're trying to steal stuff, apparently it's quite convenient.
You just alluded to a bigger thing in AI in general, which is it's still not artificial intelligence. It's human intelligence.
Yes.
And it's human intelligence where we're offshoring a lot of data categorization and sorting to these big labor centers and acting like it's an algorithm that's magically sorting everything when the truth of the matter is, we have the data is still being very intensely processed by humans at almost every step.
Yeah.
Part of me, when there were Amazon Go stores in San Francisco, did love them, but I see what Lisa is saying about these experiences benefiting from humanity, because the Amazon Go stores like had zero humanity to them, and they were kind of completely lacking in soul. Yeah. At the end, there was just like a security guy up front. I don't think retail environments benefit from not having any human aspect whatsoever when all is said and done.
Yeah. Theo Waite writing in The Information said, Amazon relies on a significant amount of human staffers to power Just Walk Out behind the scenes. Yeah. Amazon had more than 1,000 people in India working on Just Walk Out as of mid-2022, whose jobs include manually reviewing transactions and labeling images from videos. But to your point, to train Just Walk Out's machine learning model, you do have to train it with humans. They explain that's why if you've used it, it might take hours for you to get the receipt. They have to review it.
And there is a difference between when there's something on your receipt that you didn't pay for. Normally, you can go back in and talk to a human being. In this case, like you're saying,
you go talk to
support, and it's an AI chat.
It's a bot.
Do you think
have I solved your query?
No. Are we going to get used to that, or are we going to rebel against that? I mean, I know people with Gmail, for instance. There's something goes wrong with Gmail. There's no one
right. That you just accept that there's nothing you can do.
A woman called the radio show said, "I went to the Google office in Irvine and pounded on the door to see if I could get them to help me with my Gmail, but no one ever answered."
Yeah. I use Hey Email, and I have to say, maybe the best thing about it in some ways is the fact that when I have a question or a problem, I pay for it. And if I have an issue, I ping them, and a human being writes back quite quickly. And even if they tell me they have no intention of adding the feature, I suggest that. It's nice knowing there are actual people there reading my stuff.
Slate used to have, and a Google search just failed to turn it up, but I remember very distinctly Slate used to run an article once a year, which was, here is Amazon's live customer service number. Here is who you call if you want to talk to an actual live human being related to Amazon.com.
Amazon actually does have decent human support. It's just that they make it almost impossible to find.
Yeah.
If you do find that, they quite often are pretty helpful pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Lisa, I heard you the other day in the other room shouting, representative, representative. Representative! Did you eventually get a human on the other end?
Yeah. She said, I did.
Well, there's that website, gethuman.com, which tells you how to get a rep on the phone. You type in the company name and it tells you how to get to the people.
Like the button tree that you push?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
that's nice.
So that's my question is, are we going to get used to the idea that there are no human support, or are we always going to want humans? And that's really a big cost center. That's the biggest cost center of all.
So I just spent a week on this at Enterprise Connect.
Perfect.
There's a couple things going on. One, call centers are very hard to staff. You have a high rate of turnover. You have a high... And they're expensive to staff in that you have to bring agents on board. They have to then know about the service or the product, and they have to be trained in how to de-escalate situations. It's costly, as it should be, because you're taking time and effort to train people, but you have a turnover problem because these guys get really burnt out. No one ever calls into a contact center because they're super thrilled with a product and they just want to share how happy they are.
Hey, this was great.
Like, literally everybody who's calling in is already in like a low-key state of agitation.
Yeah.
They want their problem solved, and they want it solved in a specific way. And your job as a contact center agent is to de-escalate, to try to make the person happy, but also to follow whatever the service restrictions of your company are going to be. AI is seen as a way to head off more of these calls early on. The idea being if somebody calls in and they're like, I just don't know my account number, you can have a bot do that in theory. However, what this means is the people who do make it through the bot to a live person are only going to be more agitated, yes, which means that it's only going to be more unpleasant to deal with them, which means that you're only going to
be the worst job ever, right? I mean, you're only talking to the most annoyed people in the world.
Yeah, right? But the thing is human touches really do de-escalate situations much more quickly than a bot structure where you kind of have to guess the organization of the information
and figure out how to ask the question
well-trained,
that they want you to ask as opposed to the question you want to ask.
Humans, which are even more expensive. Yeah. Well-trained humans who have the power to do something, who aren't just looking through a notebook for
They're faster, though. Well-trained humans are so much faster. And AI, when it's done right, can pull up product spec information, or it can pull up similar cases where you're like, oh, I see that 3 months ago we had a customer with a similar problem. Here's how we solved it. Would that work for you? People are still faster than customer service bots. And
but I suspect that as with many AI things, a pairing of a human and an AI might be the best of both worlds.
That's how the vendors are currently selling it. I lost track of the number of times I got a vendor who got up and said, AI is going to be your colleague. It's not going to replace you.
Yeah, I think that's the way to think of it. That's the way it works. Igor in our Club Twit Discord says that whenever he uses Just Walk Out, he gets his receipt within seconds. He loves it. He's never had an inaccurate receipt. But he also says, I never want human support if possible in any way. Anthony Ilson, our own Anthony Ilson says, and I think he makes a good point, I just make it easy to manage your stuff online.
Yeah.
But the companies don't want to do that because you know what happens? It gets too easy to cancel.
Let me reset my own modem if I need to.
Yeah. The other challenge you have, this was actually a great metric I heard in the 90s when I was working in a web design shop, is you could always tell companies that were customer-focused as opposed to ones that weren't, because the ones that were customer-focused organized their website along the lines of what customers wanted and would look for. Otherwise, you'd look at the web, the site tree and be like, okay, you've just replicated your internal corporate structure. And I think that's still a problem that you have with a lot of online account management, is the website that's been rolled out makes sense to the people inside because it ties into whatever workflow they have, or however the data and the money is moved through different departments. That's not going to be the same experience the customer has, though.
Are you not a believer in the good book, the from the Saint Cory Doctorow, who says that all companies start that way, and then in shitification means that eventually they go from being customer-centric to wring every penny of profit out of the customer. That seems to be the common path.
I hate that he coined that because it's so apt and it's so depressing.
It's so true,
Once you see it, you can't unsee it. Yeah, it's everywhere.
Exactly, it is.
You cannot unsee it.
Yeah.
I got a blue check this week.
Oh, wow.
For free. Sorry, honey.
You didn't pay for it.
I want everyone
to know. Listen, everyone, he didn't pay for it.
I didn't pay for it.
I didn't ask for it.
Elon is, I guess, I don't know, is this backing down on his original plan to make the money that he needs on Twitter to make people pay for this thing?
Is he back? I don't think he knows what
I
that
lost
means.
My blue check.
Backing down? I don't think he does.
Yeah, he doesn't know that.
I thought the problem is that since Twitter activity is notably down year over year.
Yeah, maybe that's
that
the problem.
By bringing back the idea that, oh, legit, people have blue checks. It's not just lunatics paying $8 a month. More people will come back to Twitter and be like, oh, so it's not all porn bots and Nazis.
It tempted me. I thought, well, I got a blue check. I should use it.
Yeah.
If you have at least 2,500 paying followers, that's important, you can get your blue check. If you have 5,000 paying followers, you can get a Premium Plus membership. And I'm happy to say I do believe, even though I will never use it, I have a Premium Plus membership.
Ooh.
Thank you, Elon, for nothing.
Oh, my gosh. So you can use Grok, even.
I can use Grok. You want to try it?
Yes.
I finally tried Grok after this happened to me, too.
Oh, you got it, too?
Yeah.
What do you think about it? I mean, do you use Twitter? I stopped using Twitter. I just say, go to my Mastodon.
I read about this in my newsletter last week. I mean, I have not quit Twitter, but my usage is way, way down. Mm-hmm. Like, I tweeted last month in total about as much as I used to tweet in 2 days, but back in the 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And some of that has gone to Mastodon and Blue Sky and Threads, and I'm reading more newsletters. I'm trying to spend more time on Discord and Reddit, and I actually have found it's been kind of liberating to take all this time, which I used to reflexively spend on Twitter, and sometimes I just do yard work. I have way more time than I thought I did because I'm using Twitter less.
You said that. You're such a good writer. You said that exactly right. The time reflexively spent. You don't think about it. It just happens. You go, I got a minute. Let's go to Twitter. And then 5 hours later, you're still looking at it. It's kind of unconscious use.
Totally. Yeah, maybe I should have been tallying it up, and I would have been concerned about my online habits a lot more quickly if I had.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree with the members of Congress who believe that social media is a blight on our young people, and like people like Jonathan Haidt who say it's rewiring our children?
Didn't they say the same thing about comic books
they
and
did.
Television?
And books and TV and
radio,
music and rock and roll.
Yeah.
Cut your hair, you hippie. No, that was my dad. Never mind.
A little drama showed itself there for a moment.
There are things about social media that are different in the sense that with television, you were a consumer. And with social media, especially if you've got very young people who haven't developed impulse control or an appreciation of consequences, things like bullying can follow you from platform to platform.
Yeah. That's a consequence, I think. As a old white man, I don't experience so much, but people do, and it's problematic, for sure.
My daughter, who is a seventh grader, has reported, so I should caveat this, she doesn't have a phone. She'll be getting one later.
When will she get one? Ninth grade? Tenth grade? 11th grade?
Never. No. She's going to Europe in a few months, and we're getting her a phone before she goes.
Sure.
So that she can keep in touch with her tour groups, WhatsApp group.
Absolutely.
Take photos.
And again, call for help if needed.
Exactly. So she'll get one then. She's going to fill it. We have a contract for usage that we're putting together where we talk about our expectations and her expectations of us and consequences, et cetera, et cetera. So we talk about it's a tool. We expect you to use it responsibly, and we will model responsible use ourselves. Like, that's what we're doing there. To get back to the story, she doesn't have...
You make me feel like a terrible parent all the time you're on, by the way. I just want to say, I didn't do any of that. Maybe I didn't need to because it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you got to do it, right?
Yeah, it's just...
You can talk. It's okay.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Yeah. It's very different.
Yeah. It's different now.
Yeah.
Yeah. How old are your kids?
40, but I'm an
Oh, you teach. What grades do you teach?
At middle school.
Oh, my God. Well, you have more experience than any of us.
Yeah.
Are middle schoolers glued to their phones? You have to take them away? Do you have to say, put your phones down now? We're going to do something?
When I was a middle school teacher, they didn't have phones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so you're not doing it now?
No.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
Well, my daughter self-reports is that the kids who are on TikTok and social media tend to beef with each other a lot more. And have more fraught social relationships.
I think that's true
than
adults.
Than her little, crew.
You know, when somebody just cut off Twitter, they're all spun up.
Yeah.
So angry about something.
Yes.
That's what happens from this stuff. It's okay. She can speak up. You don't have to. It's okay. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. But it seems like it's another source of stress for them if they're conducting their social lives both online and offline. And she has a watch. She has group texts. We've made it clear that we expect to be able to see her texts at any time.
See, as a parent, taking away the phone, because we did have some cell phones. They weren't smartphones.
Yeah.
Was kind of a double-edged punishment because, the kid didn't have the phone, but then I didn't know where the hell a kid was.
Yeah.
And I was worried that they couldn't reach me. You know, the phone was a safety thing, it wasn't a smartphone.
I do actually have to kind of check myself that way because I remember that, when I was in middle school, my parents let me run errands. I run around with friends.
Oh, you remember that? We could go out?
Well, I always had to say, I'll be back by this time. This is who I'm with. This is where we're going. And so every once in a while, if she's out without her watch, I have to remind myself that, you know what? Parents live through this with their kids. It's going to be okay if I don't know where she is at all times. Part of my job is to learn how to be okay with her being an independent person in the world. Right. And part of her job is to prove she can be.
Right.
So,
can I follow up? You mentioned about an expectation of being able to see messages at all times. Did I unplug something? Oh, there we go. Uh-huh. Where do you draw the line on expectation of privacy for the youth, for the child? Do they have it? Do they get to have an expectation of any privacy with it? Or does that come at a certain age? I'm curious about this just as it is now, because I think even Lisa was talking about it before. Externally, we all don't have a huge expectation for privacy because there's so much tracking that goes on. But I've heard a lot of parents who talk about for their kids, giving some level of privacy. So I'm just curious where how that is for you.
So it's stepped up as she's gotten older. For example, when she was in elementary school, we made it clear we get to look at your Google search whenever we want. And I'm glad that we did, because there were a couple times when she was querying things, and I'm like, okay, I see that you're curious. Let's talk about it. And she would, I'm dying of embarrassment. I'm like,
but we've got to talk about it. Yeah.
With the text now, it's basically, we've always talked with her, don't ever put anything in writing that you wouldn't want read back to you.
That's fair.
In a court of law or on the front page of
or it. Grandma to see.
Yeah. 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 But since this is a really emotional and fraught time, if there's drama on a group text and she spun up about it.
Yeah. To be able to help you. Yeah.
Well, it's not just to be able to help. It's okay, let's get some context here. Mm-hmm. So it's something like that where we need to see, are you being bullied?
Right.
Are you saying things to someone that I'm going to hear about later? I haven't had to actually step in and look at stuff like that.
I think if more
just
kids...
Just letting her know I reserve the right to.
Yeah.
If
easily.
You would force kids to use Mastodon, everything would be okay. Just
wait,
so
why?
Boring.
Why? Oh, okay.
Quiet.
I see what you're saying.
There'd be no problems whatsoever. POTUS is now on Mastodon, the president. Yeah. But not by joining Mastodon, but by his Threads account. In fact, I just recently turned this on too. You can
that's right.
If you're a Threads user, you can go into your settings on your Threads account. I don't know why anybody would do this, but you can.
I need to turn it on.
And you can turn on what's called Fediverse sharing, and they'll give you a whole explanation. I've turned mine on, so I don't see the explanation. But then somebody on Mastodon can follow your Threads
very nice.
Account. So you know, I'm still kind of a Mastodon. Prefer Mastodon kind of guy, but that's kind of nice. It means that you can at least follow some critical, important accounts, and more, I think, over time. I think that's the best way to solve this, by the way, and I don't think this will ever happen with Twitter, but the idea of multiple small instances all over the place that are run by whoever you trust, but who then give you access to accounts on other social networks, that's pretty good. That's a good way of doing it.
I think I've just been hurt. the loss of what was once Twitter.
Well, it is a big loss. I agree.
So I have no desire.
You don't want it.
To post anywhere at any time about anything, to be perfectly honest with you. So I pretty much only occasionally share stuff that I'm doing here because for the most part, I just feel so it's draining for me to post anything anywhere at any time. I don't regularly go to these different social media sites anymore. I think I maybe post on Instagram once a year at this point, and all the rest of it, again, it's usually just, check out the thing I did on Hands on Mac. I don't feel like I have a personality on the internet anymore. And it's just because, I did that and I enjoyed it and then it went away.
For one brief shining moment. But here's the question. And the reason it's interesting that the president is on Mastodon is how important, it certainly wasn't important until roughly the time of Obama that our government had a presence on these social networks. Mm-hmm. How important is that? Is it just a way of raising money? Is it just a way of advertising? Or is it legitimately a way for government to communicate with the government?
Because that's where the journalists were, I think.
Yeah.
That was the big way to make sure that the news got to the people who were going to be sharing the news with everyone else as quickly as possible. I think if they weren't there, then maybe it would not be as important.
Well, that was the whole point of Twitter, is Twitter was kind of the town square for people who would have been obsessing over Condé Nast in the 90s.
Kanye West?
Condé Nast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm obsessing over Kanye West in the 20s, but that's a different...
I do feel like Twitter may have had a negative impact on politics and governance overall because all of these politicians and people in government wanted to be celebrities.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And people on both parties were trolling other people in a way that's not terribly constructive.
You could say 24-hour news didn't help that either, right? That's made them celebrities.
There are probably some examples of people in government have used it in a constructive and positive way, but I think they're probably outnumbered by people for whom, if they didn't have that presence, we'd all be better off.
Entire problem with social, though, is it's all performance, whether you're a government official or just some lowly person like Micah.
That's so mean.
No, I don't mean to say that. Like me, that it's really a performance in every case, that you're creating a persona. That's part of the problem, right? Is that savvy young people might think that Instagram account is real. Like that person is really that thin and beautiful and having that great a life. Mm-hmm. And anybody more sophisticated would go, well, that's all phony and staged. But isn't that what everybody's doing? And you know, this used to be the province of only of people like me who got a chance to be on TV. I don't want you people having a performance. No, I'm just saying it's bad for people, I think. To be performative instead of genuine.
Yeah. Well, it was actually Harry's employer in the 1990s who ran the cover story, a brand called You.
Indeed.
People
People are still reading that story to this day.
Was it the Time Person of the Year was You?
The Time Person of the Year was You, eventually.
But we do have, it is considered
you.
Good job advice now, even, mm-hmm. to think
branding.
Of
your, always be branding.
Think of yourself as a brand and to present yourself as a brand.
God, how depressing.
This was, what year was that,
Harry?
That one was, what, 2004?
Private, you know, company matters versus family matters. Like, people always had a public-facing persona and a private one, mm-hmm. but now we're commodifying that public-facing persona in a way mm-hmm. that is shitification.
Well, and also, how important are those, help me with the term. It's a relationship that...
Parasocial.
Yeah, parasocial relationships are becoming an expenditure. It's or becoming a product that people can buy. When you think about the a lot of subscription services, a lot of memberships
podcasts.
And all that kind of thing. Yeah, that is all about leveraging the parasocial relationship that forms. And, you will get more access to me. I'm going to do videos where I dance like a chicken, and they're only for you if you pay $50 a month. Yeah. Now, if any of you would do that, let me know, because we'd love to have
Michael
more.
Michael loves chicken.
Yeah, I love chicken dancing, and $50 a month will
this
be great.
This was prescient, though. Time Person of the Year, You. Yes, you control the information age. That dates it right there. That phrase.
Yeah, the information.
Welcome to your world. But it was kind of prescient. I think in this case, Time was saying this is a good thing, but it really turned out to be, while it's true, maybe not such a good thing.
People made fun of it at the time, but I think it probably, I haven't read it in a while, but it probably reads okay. And the Fast Company story, which Lisa mentioned, was like 10 years before that.
Because I remember.
Oh, so you thought this up. It's your fault.
Well, retroactively, yes. It was like, what?
I think a brand called You came out in Fast Company in 96. I want to say 95
or
96.
And,
this is 2006.
That's probably our most famous cover and our website. That story still gets read regularly.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that cover. It was a really well-designed cover, just beautifully graphic.
And that was kind of before they were, I don't think we were really talking about you being you on the internet so much. But
no, it was just...
It was branding yourself as a business person.
Here's what it takes to be the CEO of Me Incorporated. This is Tom Peters.
Hi, Tom Peters.
The management expert, right?
Yeah.
I believe you'll have to pay us to read the entire story, Leo.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It's a brand new world. Get it?
Yes.
Tom Peters writes, in 1996,
world.
The cross trainer you're wearing... We don't call them cross trainers anymore.
Yeah.
One look at the distinctive swoosh on the side tells everyone who's got you branded. That coffee travel mug you're carrying, you're a Starbucks woman. Your T-shirt with a distinctive champion C on the sleeve. This seems so naive and innocent. This is like a long time ago. Little did they know where we were headed.
It was really... I was working for Hotwired and sitting next to the folks from Suck at the time, and this hit like a neutron bomb. It was something where it was combining with commodify your descent from the Baffler, and the whole idea that you could commodify people or your public-facing presentation was just... It was probably one of the more influential ideas of the 1990s.
Well, I'm not going to sign up for Fast Company now, but I will sign up for the premium so that I can... I'm very curious.
It'd be well
actually.
Worth it. Yeah. Just for that story alone.
Yeah. A personal branding expert shares what it takes. Wow.
Yeah.
And in fact, Tom Peters on his own website had a piece on the 25th anniversary
oh my
of
God.
That of that piece. It's changed a lot.
Yeah.
But it was also kind of a glimpse into what the future was holding. And I have a little bit of a bias about this because, I kind of built a career to some degree doing that. But my son has done that using TikTok and then Instagram quite successfully. I mean, that's how he makes his living. And I feel bad for a whole his whole generation that all thinks they should be influencers and all thinks that there's their future. But in his case, it worked out.
Don't they say when they ask kids what they want to be when they grow up, online influencer as well?
It used to be NBA star or NFL
astronaut.
Isn't your son in cuisine? Like, that's his thing?
But it's funny. He's not a trained chef or anything.
But he's like amassed a form of expertise that's recognized.
He grew up, what happened was he grew up watching YouTube videos of all of these cooks and decided, in his head at some point, I would like to do that. But I don't know how he suddenly said, now he's got a cook. Simon & Schuster is publishing his cookbook in the fall.
That's so
cool. He's been on Gordon Ramsay's show. Yeah. He's hanging out with, big stars, and some of his TikToks get 5, 10, 20 million. This grilled cheese sandwich has 20 million views.
Oh my God, that looks so good.
Yeah, that's all it is. By the way, that's his mother's house. He's doing it from mom's house, but that doesn't seem to hurt his dating life at all. So
I think there is a lot of good that's come out of the fact that anybody can get a platform, so it's not all bad by any means.
Yeah, Leo, anyone can get a platform.
This is why I'm biased.
Let's pour one out there for BuzzFeed's food videos, though, because your son's videos remind me a whole lot of one of the appeals of BuzzFeed's cooking channel videos was it did the step-by-step and it sped up, so it looked fun as opposed to tedious, which so much cooking is tedious, but when it's sped up and montage-y, it's like cute and fun.
I can do that in 15 minutes.
No, you will be making that stock for 2 hours, friend.
I think who is responsible for those BuzzFeed videos and that style is Zay Frank. Do you remember Zay Frank?
Yes.
He was real early to that.
He was...
he had that whole creative thing where he was doing, producing a new thing a day, too.
Yeah, and he would never blink.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. He was the guy, he was afraid, he would do fast cuts.
Yeah.
He would never blink. This is in the very earliest days of the internet. And I believe he joined BuzzFeed and actually designed their recipe style.
He was like their head of video.
Yeah, it was a really distinctive style, and you see it all over TikTok now, or all over YouTube Shorts, or whatever you want to call it. But anytime you see someone cooking, it's always sped up, and
it's always about not so much as the person up. Yeah. You're looking at hands, and you're
that's Zay Frank. Yeah. That was totally his style.
There's a new. I don't know the name of the creator, but basically what they do is they decorate cakes while also reading aloud Reddit stories.
Oh, wow.
And that fascinates me because they're not... There's no instructional value whatsoever. You're just watching them pipe frosting while they're also reading about this crazy relationship drama. And I thought, this is like next level. This is the inception of the internet.
Isn't this a great opportunity for creativity?
Yeah.
So again, what we're doing here is we're talking about both the pros and the cons. Uh-huh. There's negatives, there's downsides. At the same time as... I'm glad my kid got into doing all of that and watched a lot of YouTube videos, and because it's turned out to be what he does for a living. Not that that will happen for a large number of people, but still.
The point I was originally getting at, though, was he created an area of specialty. He's like, I'm an authority.
Well, he did it right.
And like when people are like, oh, children want to be influencers, that's not necessarily bad. What you should point out, though, is if you're going to do that, you have to be good at something.
Every single barber in the barbershop.
I've talked to kids like that. I'm like, okay, but how?
Yeah.
Every single barber in the barbershop I go to has a plaque above their name with their Instagram handle.
Oh, wow.
And you're supposed to I follow mine. Mm-hmm. And she's posting, she says, follow me on my Thursday. And there's a picture of me and my haircut. It's like that's what but the thing is, if everybody's an influencer,
then nobody's influencer.
Who's watching the videos?
I don't know. Everybody's influencing someone, right?
Yeah.
Can everybody be an influencer?
If they're influencing other influencers.
Everybody can have a sphere of influence.
Yes. There we go.
We all get to be in our own
little
sphere.
And let's be reasonable. Not everybody will be an influencer.
Oh, and there's some people who are very happy to consume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And somebody's got to do it. So please, if you will, be a consumer because there's not enough room for it.
Consume my influence, please.
I swear, one of the problems, there are a number of problems with podcasting, which is struggling right now. But one of the biggest problems is every freaking body has a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are a podcast listener, it might be a little overwhelming, but your attention, you only have 24 hours in a day. It's going to be diluted a little bit. Here is your new sticker, thanks to Joe Esposito in our studio today. For
Joe is merciless.
This is the man responsible for all internet narcissism. And there's a lovely picture of...
I will take the bullet on behalf of Fast Company.
You! It's you! It's your fault! You're watching a kind of a special edition of This Week in Tech, not only because it is an in-studio for the first time in 4 years. We love it. That first of all of our panels... Our in-studio panelists, but also our great studio audience. Nice to have you here. Please don't hesitate to shout out, yell, scream. It's good for us to understand that there are people listening to what we're saying and responding just as you would at home. It's really, I don't mind at all. I like it. It's also a special occasion because this is our close to our 19th birthday. So the very first This Week in Tech... was April, let me see, I have to find it every time, I can't remember the date, twit.tv/1, I think is all I need to do. Maybe it's twit1. And the first episode will pop up, was April 17th, 2005, so 10 days away from our 19th anniversary of this show. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
That's a long time, and I haven't aged a bit, which is really remarkable, I think. I owe it all to my velvet jacket. So nice to have you in studio. Harry, you've been on this show how many times? Many, many times.
You looked it up the last time I was here.
It was 19 years. It was like forever.
More often than I remembered.
Yeah. Well, I forgot most of mine, too. I think it's a protective mechanism. Lisa Schmeiser, you've been on for many years as well. It's great to have you from No Jitter.
It's one of my favorite things to do.
Aw. Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing Girl Scout cookies.
Yes.
Did you see? There are Samoas. But I'm going to buy those. I don't want no freebies. No freebies. We're going to buy those Girl Scout cookies.
It was a gift, I promise.
I know it was.
Yeah.
And also, of course, the newest member, but a very important member of our Twit family. It's great to have Micah Sargent.
Good to be here.
In studio with us, our show today, brought to you by those good folks at Robinhood. This episode brought to you by Robinhood. Did you know that even if you have a 401k for retirement, you can still have an IRA? Robinhood is the only IRA that gives you a 3% boost on every dollar you contribute when you subscribe to Robinhood Gold. But get this, now through April 30th, Robinhood is even boosting every single dollar you transfer in from other retirement accounts with a 3% match. That's right, no cap on the 3% match. Robinhood Gold gets you the most for your retirement thanks to their IRA with a 3% match. This offer is good through April 30th. Get started at Robinhood.com/boost. Subscription fees apply. And now for some legal info. Claim as of Q1 2024, validated by Radius Global Market Research. Investing involves risk, including loss. Limitations apply to IRAs and 401ks. 3% match requires Robinhood Gold for 1 year from the date of first 3% match. Must keep Robinhood IRA for 5 years. The 3% matching on transfers is subject to specific terms and conditions. Robinhood IRA available to U.S. customers in good standing. Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, is a registered broker-dealer. Welcome back. This Week in Tech, continuing on with the week's tech news. Let's see here. Should we talk about Yahoo? Yahoo's in the news. Yeah. So there was a wonderful news app. I don't know if you ever used it. AI-driven news app created by Kevin Systrom, the man who founded Instagram, started Instagram, then was, of course, Instagram was bought by Meta, and he went to Meta and stayed there for many years. Left... is no longer running Instagram and is now started a new startup called Artifact, which 1 year in, he decided, never mind, and canceled it. Then a week later, this was last month, put out a blog post saying, oh, never mind on the never mind. We think we have a way going forward. Now the other shoe has dropped. This week we learned that Yahoo is buying Artifact, the AI news app, but they're not going to keep the app running. I still have Artifact on my phone. And, of course, I immediately went to Artifact, hoping that it would, in fact, be doing something. And then, no, it's just saying, no, it's over. So Yahoo, I guess, wanted the technology, but didn't want Artifact. Every time, every tab I go to, it says, that's all we have for you at the moment.
Wow, they moved quick.
They didn't take any time.
Merciless.
Shut the whole damn thing down.
Ghosted by your app. Oh.
It does feel like that is one of the companies where things go to die.
Yahoo?
Yeah. Tumblr.
Flickr.
Flickr.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're just not what they used to be.
Now, Tumblr is now owned by Automattic. That's true. But
Flickr,
it isn't exactly.
It is not.
Flickr is owned by SmugMug. So a lot of the stuff got dispersed eventually.
But it's like they got some sort of horrible parasite. They ingested some sort of horrible parasite that they've never recovered from or something. Because to this day, I remember Tumblr being a cool place to be and actually liking that platform.
Tumblr,
and it is not anything like it was.
I would argue there's kind of a built-in expiration date on a lot of these intensely cultured communities. Because you had the same thing with LiveJournal, which got bought by a Russian company at one point and is still kicking around. I remember a lot of online bulletin boards from the turn of the century getting bought up and killed. Tumblr is kind of the same way. MySpace was... again, an intensely cultured place that was great for discovering music and building out connections, and then just was murdered.
So maybe Yahoo's not a discerning buyer.
I think the problem is Yahoo wants to be cool and Google, but they're not. And that's not a bad thing.
Right,
not every product has to be cool. Not every product has to be cutting edge. It's a decent internet aggregator for people who don't want to spend a lot of time surfing, but still want to feel informed. Mm-hmm. The same way that you used to have news magazines that just aggregated news for you so that once a week you sat down and read them. The problem is that Yahoo was trying, it was beholden to its investors to prove they were growing, and it was trying to find new audiences and new niches. And I think that's where a lot of their disastrous buys came from, is they're like, this will get us in with the Young Youngs, or...
And that was their first problem, looking for getting in with the Young Youngs.
Yeah.
There's that insurification.
The China lent to the Washington Institute. Am I wrong on that? I believe so.
Like we were saying, I mean, yours... Yahoo does have a ton of content.
Yeah.
And if all they want is some AI that might be helpful figuring out which content to serve to which people, there might be some value there.
I would love it if Yahoo rose like a phoenix from its ashes.
If it becomes the USA Today of the 2020s,
that
is that
great?
So bad?
Would anybody be against that? Yeah. I think that'd be wonderful.
Now, the money quote in the Verge story, which I think explains everything, is coming from... the co-founder system, where he says a lot of organizations care deeply about news and personalized content, and I think they're looking around and saying, wow, there's this new wave of AI, maybe we should figure out what's going on. And so
he says also maybe that's what I discounted originally,
but what he's basically saying,
catching up.
What he's basically saying is, look, organizations have decided there's value in offering highly curated or customized news feeds to people.
I loved Artifact.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Remember Nuzzle?
Yes. Nuzzle, oh my gosh, I really liked
bought
Nuzzle.
By Twitter, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Twitter bought it and basically let it, I guess it's part of Twitter Blue, but it's not the same.
Not at all.
Years ago, Yahoo bought a company called Sumly, which was using AI to figure out which stories to show to which people, and that became Yahoo News Digest in the Marissa Meyer era. And then went away, so they're definitely coming back at an old idea, but maybe the AI is ready for prime time now.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the biggest challenges in news and information, period, is readers or surfers will always, oh, there's a flood of news, I don't know where to start. And so giving people the bespoke experience is always going to be the end goal. It's good for advertisers, or it's good for subscriptions or whatever, but when you have people do it, it's tremendously labor intensive. So being able to have technology do it would be great.
Going full circle back to our self-driving car thing.
Yeah.
Where you said, I want people.
Yeah. Well,
maybe there's places we don't need people. I feel like news ought to have people.
So, again, having spent a week having people say, oh, you know, AI is coming for your job.
It's not coming for your job.
No, it's not.
In fact, every time some publication, whether it's CNET or Sports Illustrated, starts proffering AI-written articles, it's a huge problem.
With the caveat that I'm not sure the current Substack boom is sustainable because we only have so many subscriptions we're willing to pay $50 a year for.
That's true. Every time I want to read something, I go, another
subscription?
Like I
do think there is a real hunger in audiences for content that is written by people who know what they're talking about, or is curated by or edited by people who know what they're talking about. And if something like Artifact can be used as an assistive device to help editors better serve their public, that's great.
You know, though,
like, I would love it if I had a tool where if I'm editing a story, a tool pops up and says, hey, you've also edited 4 other stories on a 4-day work week in the past year.
Yeah, that's useful.
Why don't you roll this in and let's see if we can put together a digest based on these insights from those stories. Mm-hmm. Like, that would be amazing.
But
because it's something I could offer readers to say, hey, this is the year-long story we're evolving. This is the most recent installation of it. I'd love something like
that. As a consumer, though, what worked for me for Nuzzle and somewhat Artifact was not an auto-generated one, but this is what people you're following are reading.
Yeah.
This is what people you're following are interested in. That is essentially harnessing the real power, human power, of mm-hmm. of the people I follow. And that's really useful. That's really good. Better than some AI saying, well, based on what... That never works out. Based on what you've been reading... Yeah. Those never work out.
I would be more likely to read something if I knew one of the three of you recommended it, to be frank.
Right. Exactly.
Because I trust you guys in your judgment. And I think if AI can help with that, or if AI can help pull things together to give people a more complete view, like as a consumer, I think that would be great.
But it's reasonable for companies like Yahoo to look at least.
Yeah.
Because as you say, it's very expensive to do this human stuff. That's why Nuzzle, and to some extent Artifact, was genius, well, they're not doing any extra work. They're just aggregating, you know, they're linking into, and this is, you know, Twitter really blew this because Twitter could have done it very well.
Yeah.
They're aggregating links from your friends and the people you follow.
I mean, there wasn't even any real AI involved with Nuzzle. It just turns out that if you have interesting friends and they're sharing stuff, it's a pretty good sign you might also be interested.
Yeah.
Mr. Beast says, slow down.
Yeah, we're going away from the Zay Frank.
Talk about influencers. Mr. Beast, who is, I believe, now number one on YouTube by a long shot, made his name. He's very clear about it. He studied the algorithm. He had a team of people going back to his high school years studying the algorithm and feeding the algorithm, basically, what it would promote to his viewers, and it's worked quite well. In fact, it's worked so well that it's sometimes called the beastification of YouTube. Jimmy Donaldson, that's the real name of Mr. Beast, built his reputation by, and this is from the Washington Post, creating hyper-engaging, fast-paced videos with frequent action on screen. I will add loud noises, flashing lights, and no pauses. That was the style. He's now saying... Stop. pretty much everybody is copying Mr. Beast. Earlier this month, he tweeted a plea to his fellow YouTubers to stop doing it. Get rid of, he said. Here, I'm pulling up the tweet right now. Get rid of the ultra-fast-paced, over-stim era of content. It doesn't even work, which is kind of rich coming from a guy who's been using this to make his name.
The Washington Post story has a bunch of experts saying, actually, it works quite well.
Maybe Mr. Beast doesn't like the competition, Mr. Beast, huh? Mm. He says this in his tweet, the last year I've slowed down our videos, focused on storytelling, let scenes breathe, yell less, more personality, longer videos. Basically, he's turning his style into mine. Basically, we just start doing 3-hour shows and...
He got old, Leo.
He got old. That's what happened. Benito, our producer.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know what to make of this, right?
I mean, like you said, he made his money by studying the algorithm. He claims in the part right before he says, slow down, do everything, is that the algorithm seems to have changed because he said by changing to this more storytelling style, by slowing down, he says, quote, my views skyrocketed. So he's claiming that that shift is actually better for the numbers. But as you said, then there were the Washington Post folks who said, no, that's not better for the numbers. Does anyone really know?
Let me look at my son's videos. Is this, would you say, fast-paced editing?
I'm so hungry.
Actually, he slowed down towards the end. I think he speeds it up when he's making it. Oh, this is an ad for King's Hawaiian Bread. He speeds it up when he's making it and then slows down to eat it. I think this is all very conscious.
I'm sure.
Very, very calculated. I think he did what Mr. Beast did to kind of figure out what the style is that would generate the... Now, this is early days of TikTok that would generate the most... because TikTok, the whole key of TikTok is getting the algorithm to boost mm-hmm. you. It isn't really getting people to like you or follow you or anything.
Right.
It's getting whatever magic algorithm TikTok has to promote you, and almost instantly you get millions
of
views.
That algorithm is going to be influenced by people, though.
Do we know?
There was a story early in the pandemic talking about how, and it's one of the few that came out of like the whole black box of how TikTok mm-hmm. works, but for a while... the people who were responsible for tweaking the TikTok algorithm were deliberately waiting or pushing out videos where people had really nice houses. Like, you had a bunch of kids making, I'm bored, it's the pandemic, I'm at home videos. The ones who were making them in 4,000 square foot houses with marble countertops in their kitchens were getting boosted into people's feeds a lot more than the ones where the kids were living in just, you
know, that's probably why he was using his mom's kitchen.
Yeah. Modest ranch houses. So there are people putting thumbs on the scale with the algorithm at different points.
The Post quotes influencer, 17-year-old, mm-hmm. who works as a freelance video editor for social media content creators. She's 17.
Good for her.
Dara Pesheva. She says, every 1.3 to 1.5 seconds, you have to have a new graphic or something moving. You have to use a lot of effects for every image and every transition. You have to add a sound effect. Henry, by the way, does all of that.
Yeah.
You need flashing graphics, and you have to have subtitles in every video. That's kind of true. But she then says, people around my age can't focus.
I wonder why.
They have very short attention spans. They're used to TikTok. Oh, she says that's why she's adjusted to this short form, because that's the audience.
Editors have to adjust for Gen Z. So this raises an interesting thing is, could you... have there been any studies taking a look at people's attention spans relative to social media use? Like, aside from the alarmist, it's killing our children's brains. Right. Like, has any researcher actually tried to set up any study that takes a look at what happens to people's ability to concentrate or complete tasks
depending
on social media
use?
And
we talked about this last week, but there's a great debate going on right now, mm-hmm. and this all was prompted by Jonathan Haidt's new book called The Anxious Generation, mm-hmm. How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness.
Like, why wouldn't they be anxious about...
I think they're anxious about a lot of things, like climate change. But Candace Audgers, who's the author of many of these studies, wrote in Nature that he's confusing correlation with causation, which is a common problem. Yes, there's a correlation there, but she says there are no studies that support this idea that our children's brains are getting rewired or that there is an epidemic of short attention span. She does say, though, that there is a rise in mental health issues in young people. But why? That might be, you're right, it might be because of the world around them, but it also might be they're reporting it more.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's okay to report it more. She also says focusing on social media detracts from some of the real solutions that we need to look at. She points out that of every 1,119 students in the United States, there's only one school psychologist. Yeah. So there aren't a lot of places kids can go to get
our former
solutions.
Educator, what are your thoughts on this?
It's a mess.
Yeah.
It's a mess because the technology that kids are exposed to is, for the most part, inappropriate for their age.
Well, that's a whole different issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're exposed to stuff that you and I were not exposed to when we were their age.
It's really inappropriate.
Yeah. But maybe that's us judging it as inappropriate. Maybe, I mean, when we were young, we were exposed to rock and roll, and our parents didn't think that was so appropriate either.
When you say it's inappropriate, how? Because I just want to make sure I understand how you're using the word.
Visually, you know, it's like boom, boom, boom,
Yeah.
So there's no attention. Mm-hmm. You talk about attention span. There's no attention span at all. There's just like... Mm-hmm. No.
That started with MTV.
Actually,
right?
You don't read a book,
right?
You just don't sit down and read a book.
Yeah.
But people, when books came out, when novels were widely read, Jeff Jarvis has brought this up many times. There were a lot of scary articles about people's imaginations withering because they were told what to imagine instead of thinking it up on their own. I mean, there's always been...
Louisa May Alcott actually wrote a polemic against novels in one of her books.
Really?
Yes.
The author of many a novel.
Yes. Yeah, well, that
She was the Little House on the Prairie.
No, she did Little Women, Little Men.
Little Women, that's right.
Yeah, she basically wrote for money because her dad, the fruitarian, didn't provide. So,
She just did it because she had to.
Yeah, she basically did it because she had to.
I think it goes way back before Mr. Beast or even MTV. Like Sesame Street was way faster than Captain Kangaroo.
And
I'm pretty confident that Sesame Street was kind of controversial early on because the cuts were so fast and it was something new every 10 seconds. And people
But you watch it now and it's so slow paced compared to, well, the shows from the 70s are so slow paced compared to what they
are now.
We
should watch some Captain Kangaroo together.
And the Children's Television Workshop was using research at the time saying, you know, we're dealing with kids and the attention spans they have as small children, but those attention spans have changed.
Humans, though, are marvelously adaptive.
Yeah.
And I think it's easy to overestimate the damage that's being done.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think you do raise a good point about
reading, though, which is the ability to engage in a text in a protracted way and be able to sink into a book and like, do you guys all remember reading with complete absorption when you were younger, like just being able to get lost in a book for hours?
I loved that,
you know, just things like that. I've watched kids who do that today and then that still happens, but it is a skill that you have to encourage them to practice and cultivate.
I actually put some Captain Kangaroo on YouTube, and it's gotten a ton of views.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Are you old enough to have watched Captain Kangaroo as a kid?
I loved Captain Kangaroo.
Yeah, me too.
And there's not a whole lot of the early stuff online, and I put up two episodes from the 1960s.
Who owns that?
He was on CBS. I'm not sure if they own it.
We don't know who owns it is the answer. You're posting Captain... Where are you finding it?
These were VHS tapes I bought years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
There is more of like the more recent stuff where he's in color.
But you are posting the black and white stuff?
I put up two 1960s ones.
This one's from the year of my birth, 1956.
You just don't understand, Grandfather. I have got to have the keys to open the door to the treasure house.
I think, though, Mr. Rogers was a very calming, soothing... Yeah. I really loved very Mr. safe. Rogers' point of view.
Yeah.
But again, it's us parents kind of deciding what would be right for our young people. I have faith that young people will survive this as they survive the onslaught of Captain Kangaroo and movies and radio and books and locomotives and cars and all the other things that have been menaces to children. We will survive. I survived rock and roll. Didn't poison my mind. I don't know.
These kids these days have an innate understanding because they don't know anything else. And they understand it way better than we do.
Maybe. And maybe we're preparing them for the world that they're going to be living in, whether we like it or not. I mean, there's the other, you know, risk of, you know, if you have a kid and you say, well, no screen time for you. When it gets to college, what's life going to be like for him? You know, is he going to be able to talk to his peers? Is he going to be ready for the world he's going to inhabit?
Oh, my God. Can you imagine?
My son's a grad student at Oregon State, and I asked him how the freshmen and sophomores are doing in this way. And he said, okay.
Yeah, they're surviving.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I have faith. I think the human brain is marvelously adaptable. And we've survived a lot worse than this.
I'm just eager to see, frankly, the heart of it. I'm eager to see more research being done specifically about all of this.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is kind of an argument there that if we focus too much on one specific thing, we miss out on research opportunities for however else things might be impacted. And you just brought up that really good question that I would love to know. Have we, over time, done research on attention span? To see if attention spans truly have changed or if maybe we are just more aware of how one's attention span shifts over the course of their life. Is that what's different, or genuinely are the attention spans shorter, or are their attention spans being used in such a way that they're, you know, it's just focused on something else? There's a lot of questions that I, as a person who's not a child psychologist, am not going to try and say is this or is that. And I'm curious. I just want to see more research is basically.
I mean, adolescents are always novelty seeking and stimulation seeking. It's part and parcel of your brain growing from childhood to adulthood. That's why they engage in risky behaviors and act out socially. It's their brains desperate for stimulus. The thing I'd like to see studied is...
So that's what's going on with Leo.
The thing I want to see studied is, does having easy availability to countless types of stimulus with gaming systems and YouTube and TikTok and all that, is that affecting how that brain matures and gets to an adult point? Or is this like, well, it was hot rod racing in the 1950s and now it's watching TikTok
though,
videos?
It's notoriously difficult to do in vivo human studies.
Oh, yeah.
Really hard to do. It's why we have such bad information about diet, about everything, right? Because humans, you can't really study them. There's so many variables. And the real problem with studies like that is they bear the imprimatur of science. And so people decide this is true. This is the way it is. And then you get people acting on that. And I think the last thing we want is a Congress marching in and saying, okay, we're going to ban social media or we're going to ban TikTok. Yeah. Louise Matsakis had a great article in Wired this week. The guy who, most of D.C. is listening to about the dangers of TikTok, turns out he only worked there for 6 months. He made up a lot of stuff, but it spoke to what Congress, certain members of Congress wanted to believe. TikTok said, you know, he's... Here's what Louise wrote. He worked at TikTok as a risk manager. In a wrongful termination lawsuit filed against TikTok, he alleges he was fired for refusing to sign off on Project Texas. That was the move to get all our U.S. data stored by Oracle in Texas. Mm-hmm. But Louise says he worked at TikTok for 6 months. He did not have a senior position. His lawsuit and a second one he filed against several U.S. government agencies makes a number of improbable claims. He says he was put under 24-hour surveillance by TikTok and the FBI while working remotely in Mexico. In other words, there's a lot of evidence this guy might be a nut job.
He says Merrick Garland wickedly instigated his firing.
Yeah. Nevertheless, because he's saying something members of Congress want to believe, want to think is true.
They feel it in their gut.
They feel it in their gut is true. The Senate passed a law banning TikTok. I mean, the House passed a law banning TikTok. Fortunately, I think cooler heads have prevailed in the Senate. So it may not. But Biden said, I'll sign it if the Senate passes it. So I think there's a lot. Yes, it's good to have the research. It's good to get the information. It's bad to act on it. That's what I'm saying. And it's certainly bad for government to act on it. I don't think that's the right way to solve this. I've argued against any ban on TikTok. And again, I have a little bit of a dog in this. I admit it. Anybody?
I don't. And I still feel
you're a
that,
young.
I feel you? That I've talked before plenty because we've especially on Tech News Weekly have an opportunity to talk regularly kind of about where things stand. And I've been uncomfortable with the whole thing from the get-go because of what I still feel is a heaping helping of xenophobia, paired with my overall concern about how a ban like this would be enacted and what it would do in terms of the privacy and security of the millions of people probably who are still going to use TikTok even if it's banned, but are just going to get it through an illicit means. And then they've got some app that isn't signed and they're all jailbreaking their phones because they got to get their TikTok. And that is terrifying to me. So I have concerns on that front as well. And again, there are so many more aspects of this that we, you know, are like missing because we're paying such heavy attention to this specific situation. It feels odd to me.
There's that LBJ quote, better to have him inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent
it's
pissing
so LBJ.
In. And I keep thinking if you're banning TikTok, all you're doing is kicking them outside the tent too.
Well, and let's face it, there are Russian and Chinese influence campaigns on Twitter right now, on Meta right right now.
On Instagram. They're everywhere.
That is proven. That is actually proven that it's there. We know
the Chinese government, as well as our own government, buy information, as we were talking about earlier, from data brokers. Banning TikTok will do absolutely nothing.
It's not going to make our country safer. It's not going to make our people safer. Yeah. It's not going to stop our children's brains from leaking out their ears, as people are presuming.
The guy who got this all started, maybe...
bad information.
It does seem somewhat performative, and it's not something where I trust Congress to get it right, even if there is an argument in favor of doing that. And there certainly are smart people who do think that there's a problem here.
Yeah. Brianna Wu argued quite eloquently for it a couple of weeks ago on this show. Let's take a little break. Harry McCracken, the technologizer, is here. Lisa Schmeiser from No Jitter. Our good friend, Micah Sargent. You're watching This Week in Tech. Our show today brought to you by Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Talking about AI. Bad guys are using AI in very creative ways to compromise users, to breach organizations. These are headlines we've talked about on this show, from high-precision phishing emails to video and voice deepfakes of CEOs and celebrities. In a world where employees are working everywhere, apps are everywhere, data is everywhere, firewalls, VPNs are just not doing the job to protect organizations. They're not designed for these distributed environments, nor are they designed for these sophisticated AI-powered attacks. In fact, firewalls and VPNs have become the attack surface. In a security landscape where you got to fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by, get this, 500 trillion daily signals. You need to do that, though. You need to know what's happening right now to protect yourself. Zscaler's Zero Trust Plus AI helps defeat AI attacks today by enabling you to automatically detect and block advanced threats, even new threats that have never been seen before, discover and classify sensitive data everywhere, generate user-to-app segmentation, which limits lateral threat movement, to quantify risk, to prioritize remediation, and to generate board-ready reports. Because you got to keep the board on your side too, right? Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and other AI attacks while gaining the agility of the cloud. Experience your world secured. Visit Zscaler.com/Zero Trust AI. That's Zscaler.com/Zero Trust AI. We thank Zscaler so much for supporting This Week in Tech. Let's see. Oh, I had a good story here. So talking about zero-day exploits, there are companies that buy these, you know, presumably to sell them on to bad guys or governments. There is a startup now offering a pretty pretty high price for tools to hack iPhones, Android devices, WhatsApp, and iMessage. A startup named CrowdFence, F-E-N-S-E, published its updated price list for 0 days. If you have a 0 day to break into iPhones, $5 to $7 million.
Wow.
0 days to break into Android phones are not so good. $5 million. Chrome and Safari 0 days, $3 to $3.5 million, $3 to $5 million for WhatsApp and iMessage 0 days. This is a big jump, in some cases 50% higher than the last price list published a few years ago. It is clearly, I mean, if you want to make money.
Yeah, seriously. But I wonder then about the aspects of that in terms of how you as an individual find a 0 day, for example.
Oh, no, no. These are people who do this for a living.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that would mean you'd have to have like a company on your side with lawyers and stuff, because whenever you decide you try to sell it, why would they actually give you the money that you're selling it to?
Oh, believe me. So there are two companies. We've talked about this on Security Now. Zerodium, we've talked about a lot. CrowdFence is like Zerodium. These are companies that buy 0 days not to tell the company responsible, Apple or Microsoft or Google, how to fix it, but to sell it to, you know, people like, you know, Pegasus or North Korean hackers. And that's why there's so much money in this. That's why it's hard to compete with these bug bounties that these companies create, because they're not going to offer, Apple's not going to offer you $7 million.
I guess that's what I'm saying.
So if you're a bad guy that's come up with this and you don't have a conscience,
yeah,
you go to Zerodium or you go to Crowdfence.
But a bad guy working with a bad guy, isn't that second bad guy? Like, why would they actually pay?
There's trust among thieves.
That, I guess, which I think is wild, but there is. That's all I'm saying.
Google said in a report last month it saw hackers use 97 zero-day vulnerabilities in the wild in 2023. 97. Spyware vendors, who often buy these zero days from brokers, were responsible for 75% of zero days targeting Google products and Android, according to Google.
Jeez Louise.
This is an article from TechCrunch, Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchiera.
Yeah.
Lorenzo's good.
Yes.
And this is a very interesting story, and also perhaps a little bit scary. Crowdfence currently offers the highest, according to Lorenzo, publicly known prices outside of Russia. There is a company in Russia called Operation Zero. They announced last year they were willing to pay up to $20 million for tools that hack iPhones and Android devices.
Yeah, I don't think you're getting your money from Russia is all I'm saying. I just don't believe that.
Well, you could figure it out. You could give them everything but the last bit of the code and then say, "Here's, give me the money," and you get the last line.
And they'll say, look, well, we can figure out the last bit of code.
There must be an escrow. There must be some sort of hacker escrow service. That there must be a way to do this, right?
Like some sort of bank that all the bad guys.
Oh, the Cayman Islands.
The Cayman Islands.
The Bahamas?
The Bahamas. Yeah. The other places.
Actually, a guy who works at Lynchpin says the price Crowdfence is offering is below market.
Oh,
good grief.
Oh, my God.
Below black
and
market.
And you can see how, let's say I'm a person with some skills, mm-hmm. with a Z.
Exactly, and, yes. Sunglasses and skills.
And I know how to do this. That's a pretty big payday to turn down. And if you could go to Google and say, I found a hole in Android, and they say, well, here's a couple hundred thousand.
Right.
That's a $20 million.
What's the legal stuff here?
Oh, it's completely illegal. Yeah. You might have to move to Russia to spend that money. But
yeah, see, that's mostly just a relocation fee.
By the way, the FBI uses them in 2016. Lorenzo writes the FBI used a zero-day from a company called Azimuth. To break into the iPhone of the San Bernardino shooter. Oh, yeah. That's, I guess, how we found out. That was a zero day. They went to Apple. Apple said no. So they said, never mind, we found somebody. Motherboard revealed in 2020, the FBI, with the help of Facebook and an unnamed third party, used a zero day to track down a trafficker, a human trafficker.
Yeah.
There have been several cases where zero days and spyware have been used to target human rights dissidents and journalists in Ethiopia, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. I don't know what to say about this. I'm sure Steve will talk about it on security now, but it's hard. You can see why there is.
Yeah, why would you?
Why would you? You just say, well, look, $20 million, I'm sorry. So I know if that's Putin's going to use it against Ukraine.
Change my face and move away.
Yeah. Like,
yeah. This is why we live in a kind of scary world.
Precarious.
Precarious world. Apple has changed.
I want the movie adaptation.
Yeah.
No?
Oh, you know, this. We were talking last week about XZ, this really interesting hack that was probably a nation state hacker who 2 years ago sort of started to gradually infiltrate his way into an open source project so that he could introduce malware into it, which...
great New York Times story.
It's a great piece. Yeah. Just the luck of the draw that a Microsoft researcher, not a security researcher, but just a guy who was responsible for their Linux distribution, said, you know, it's taken me half a second too long, 500 milliseconds too long to log into my SSH. Yeah. There's something wrong here, and he found it. If it weren't for that,
bad,
who knows? And this was somebody with a lot of patience, gradually wormed their way in. It was a movie.
You know what it reminds me of is there was a great book that came out in the 90s, The Cuckoo's Egg.
Oh, yeah. Cliff Stoll.
Cliff Stoll.
Yeah, no,
where
Cliff
the reason he was able to break out the Russian hackers was he was like, there's a half penny discrepancy in the billing time on this machine. He was responsible for the code that maintained the machine. He wanted to see where the discrepancy
If you know Cliff Stoll, and I think you do, you totally believe that. He is the craziest guy ever.
Yeah.
We used to have him on Tech TV as the anti-editor, and he would rail against technology and
computing. Did he write Silicon Snake Oil?
Yes.
Which
that was his number two. He was
at the time people made fun of that, but maybe in retrospect,
he might have been right.
He might have been right.
No, he was like, "Who's ever going to pay attention to URLs?" And I remember the time being like, "He has a point."
He currently here's a picture of him in his attic. Yeah, he sells Klein bottles.
Yeah,
you know what a Klein bottle is? It's a infinite loop.
Yeah,
and I guess I don't know if he's a glass blower, but he sells.
He is now. Yeah,
yeah. There's a wild video of him sending his robot into the attic to pick out a Klein bottle to
What are you even saying? Do those words all go together?
Yes. Yeah. All right. So here he is. He's got a forklift robot. This is from Wired
to kill me
that he sends out into his attic space where he has a bunch of Klein bottles. So these are actually I should get one of these.
Yeah.
Cliff came on Tech TV and made a Macintosh goldfish tank.
Oh.
Once for us. He's a very strange
The Cuckoo's Egg is just a classic in the genre.
It's a great book.
I really encourage anybody who hasn't read it to read it because it's just such a great snapshot of a really specific time in computer history as well. And like a love letter to the Bay Area in the 80s. And I love that book.
His little robot forklift is found. Yeah. The Klein bottle he's looking for. He's going. It's a second quality big Klein bottle.
Yeah.
And he's now going to retrieve it and bring it back.
And it's he doesn't just go and get it himself. Why?
Yeah.
It's a small hole.
Because he can, I guess.
This is just Cliff. That's just Cliff. I love Cliff. Yeah. We should, I'll call him up, see if we can get him on the show. And I definitely want one of his Klein bottles.
But yeah, I read that New York Times story and was instantly reminded of Cuckoo's Egg, where all it takes is one person is like, this doesn't make sense. And the next thing you know.
But that's exactly what you said.
Yeah.
Half-set discrepancy. Something's wrong. And people like Cliff, that was it. That's all it took to get him to go out and find the Klein bottle. Yeah. Or no, find the Klein bottle. Who was the hacker? Was it German kid, right?
Who
did it, I think.
Yeah.
It
had something to do. It was part of the Cold War. That's what I remember.
Yeah. Okay. Apple is now allowing game emulators. They're slowly opening up the App Store. In fact, because
under penalty
the
of,
EU now, music apps can say, if you want to buy the song, give us your email address. We'll send you an email that tells you how you can use our external website to buy the song, which for Apple is a big concession. I don't know if the EU is going to accept it, but music streaming apps can now take users to a website and. Now, everywhere, game emulators. This is the first time they've allowed that.
I hope that my beloved iDOS, which I talked about here after it was banned, might come back. The DOS emulator for an iPad, which lets you play old DOS games and even old TRS-80 games.
Now, I just got my little... I should show you my little Atari 400.
I saw that in the corner.
It's so cute.
It is adorable.
Can you reach it? Is it over there?
I can get it.
Yeah. It's over there on the table. Sorry to make you do that, Micah, but you are.
How's the keyboard?
My personal.
Does the keyboard even work?
It doesn't do anything.
Aww.
Did you have an Atari 400?
I still have my Atari 400.
I'm jealous. That was my first real big boy computer.
Mine too.
And this is the cutest little mini version of it. Look at that. Isn't that cute?
Adorable.
But it's just a game machine. It does come with a full-size, thank goodness. I don't think I could use a little mini Atari joystick, but it's pretty much like the old Atari joystick. It plugs in the back of this, and there's 25 games. Star Raiders is on here. Battle Zone, Asteroid, Centipede. We played Miner 2049er on the Ask the Tech Guys show.
Seems worth having just to put on your desk.
Yeah. I know. It was $119. How could I not get that? The original 400 was $400, and that was back when a dollar was worth something. Look at that thing. No, I was hoping. I knew it was a faint hope, but I was hoping that those little keys would
Well, they were terrible in the first place, so not working at all isn't that much different.
No, I agree.
He was going to hire a mouse to type for him.
I typed in many a computer program from, I don't remember what, the, was it Compute? Atari Basic computer program.
Can you open up it up where their cartridge slots were originally, or is that sealed?
No, that's sealed. But you know what? We had Jerry Ellsworth on the show many years ago. She made a joystick. I have it in my museum that had a Commodore 64 game emulator. And she said, I didn't tell the company, but I put a backdoor that let you drop into a Commodore Basic so that you can't actually do everything that you would have done on a Commodore 64. And I wouldn't be surprised if whoever wrote the little Atari emulator on there put a little backdoor in there. We'll have to find if it was you. Tell us.
Reach out.
Tell us. Anyway, I think Apple is kind of starting to maybe, is it too early to say bend? Just the tiniest
sway.
To sway. They do say you're responsible for all such software offered in your app, including ensuring that such software complies with these guidelines and all applicable laws. In other words, no pirated ROMs. Here you go. This is Jerry Ellsworth's C64. It was just a little joystick that hooks up to your TV. This is how old it is. The Atari has an HDMI adapter. This thing has composite adapters. And but she told me there's a little back door, probably up, down, left, right, up, down, that will get you into the C64, Commodore 64 Basic. So that's cool. Anyway, actually, do you want to give away your Jerry Ellsworth augmented reality game at some point? Anthony Nielsen bought Jerry's game, which was you have a tabletop and you put on some glasses and it's augmented reality. And he hasn't played it once. I think he's going to give it away to some lucky audience member after the show. He said, can I give this away? Because I'm sure somebody would appreciate it. This was a huge story in the New York Times this weekend. And I think it's hysterical. Apparently, OpenAI decided that they needed more training information. This is going to be the gold rush. Mm-hmm. Going forward with AIs. They already ate the entire internet. We need more! So OpenAI in 2021 said, you know what? There's all this great stuff on YouTube. They created a tool, which I use to this day, called Whisper. It's a great transcription tool. They created it specifically to transcribe audio from YouTube videos so that they can use it to train their AI. The New York Times.
Let's hope they didn't use it on any Disney properties.
let me read on. Cade Metz, Cecilia Kang, uh-huh. Shira Frankel, Stuart A. Thompson, and Nico Grant writing for the New York Times.
Oh, that's a murderer's row of great journalists.
I know.
Holy cats.
Some OpenAI employees discussed how such a move might go against YouTube's rules, three people with knowledge of the conversation said. YouTube, which is owned by Google, prohibits use of its videos for applications that are independent of the video platform. Ultimately, they said, I'll screw it. And they went ahead and did it, transcribing more than 1 million hours of YouTube videos.
Get them, Disney.
The team included Greg Brockman, OpenAI's president, who personally helped collect the videos. The texts were then fed into GPT-4, which is the current state-of-the-art OpenAI. And probably, really, the benchmark for everybody making an LLM.
I did not have Justine Bateman speaking out on the ethics of OpenAI on my bingo card. But if you did, congratulations. You've just filled in your square.
Did she say?
Justine Bateman, filmmaker, former actress, and author of two books, told the Copyright Office that AI models were taking content, including her writing in films, without permission or payment. This is the largest theft in the United States, period, she said in an interview.
This is the debate, of course.
Love that she's bringing this up.
In fact, Kathy Gellis, who's been on our shows many times, is an attorney, an expert in intellectual property, says that is part of the free speech. It's not just the right to speak, but the right to read. Now, the question is, humans have the right to read. You have a right to read Justine Bateman's book. You even have the right to memorize it and repeat it back to me. Is an AI different? Is OpenAI different? And right now, it's unclear. The courts have generally supported AI's right to do this. Now, that is violating Google's policy. So, last year, Meta apparently discussed buying Simon & Schuster. just to get their library of books.
You read Kara...
Swisher?
Swisher's latest book, right?
No, of course not.
Oh, okay.
Not a fan.
No.
Tell me about it.
So I did not know that.
You read it? You legally read a copy? You can now tell me about it without in any way violating her intellectual property rights.
Yeah, I didn't realize that.
That's a long story.
So the myth that she builds of herself over the course of the
book. That's my problem.
The myth that she builds is that she was the visionary who saw that everything that can be digitized will be digitized. And this is a theme that she brings up repeatedly in her book, but I'll say that looking to buy a publisher just so you have access to its corpus certainly doesn't do much to disprove.
Now, I should mention that Google broadened its terms of service so that it could tap publicly available Google Docs, restaurant reviews on Google Maps. I think Google may also be doing, Google transcribed YouTube videos to harvest text for its AI models, according to five people with knowledge of the company's practices.
What I love is the thought that the reason why we actually have transcriptions built into YouTube is not because it was a good and great thing to
train the AIs, baby,
release to the public, but it was because it was so it could train its AI system.
Accessibility, schmeccessibility. Yeah, exactly. It's all about our dumb robot overlords.
I am, though. I think I'm
that is wild.
Contrarian in all this.
Yeah.
But I really think AI should be allowed to read everything. The last thing you want is an AI that's trained only on public domain information. If you can read Kara's book, the AI should be allowed to read Kara's book.
The biggest problem you have with AI is data quality, period.
Right.
And
so
this
how do you
is something
get
that we're not well, I think you have a lot of AI startups that are somehow assuming the data will create itself in a time when we're gutting the content industry, in a time when we're gutting basic
research.
Well,
it's a race between the collapse of the content industry and the AIs. And if the AIs could just read everything before all of us writers and creators
get driven out of business by the bots that are now writing the SEO glurge. Yeah.
Well, and this is one of the problems with AI right now is that there is such a dearth of information. They're proposing that they train on other AIs' creations.
But no, because you still don't have a really good model for that. You've got a problem. I believe somebody called it the Habsburg data model, where eventually it just gets so iteratively bad that a couple iterations into training, it bears no resemblance to the original data set.
They all get the bleeders
disease.
What you
were trying to do. Yeah.
The idea of that these great publishers with long histories could end up being most valuable essentially by providing chum to large tech companies is incredibly depressing.
Now, remember, the Times does have a dog in this fight. They sued OpenAI because they felt that OpenAI was using copyrighted news articles. I think it's going to be very interesting to see what the courts say, because you can make a fair use argument and that these AIs are doing nothing different than a human would do to read this content. And as Kathy's pointed out, there is a risk, if courts rule against this, of infringing, in fact, the right to read for humans as well. Because wouldn't copyright holders like that? Yeah. They'd love to shut down libraries because you didn't pay for that book.
Yeah.
More than 10,000 trade groups, authors, companies, Justine Bateman.
I just want to know if someone in Disney's legal office, if there's like some poor intern who's been assigned to like chat somebody up at OpenAI to see any of the videos trained on are Marvel trailers, maybe?
Chat somebody up implies it's sort of like this undercover thing where they're getting to know them.
Yeah,
they start
just
a relationship.
Hey, how's
okay,
it going?
That's what you mean by chat somebody up.
How's it going? You wouldn't happen to have used any Disney movie trailers when training your AI, did you?
If AI were to. I mean, it may be that AI is worthless. It may be AI is the new you, right? It's going to be on the cover of every magazine, and then it turns out to be another AI winner. But if it is going to be what it could be, it's going to only be that if it can ingest as much information as possible. And I think there is a chance, maybe not a lot, but there is a chance that AI could create the next cure for cancer, that AI could solve hereditary childhood diseases, that AI could solve a lot of problems if it's given enough information.
I'd like to push back on the phrasing that you have AI could solve this, because what AI it's neither artificial nor intelligence. It's just a way to do large-scale pattern matching and large-scale pattern extrapolation based on previous data. But what AI could do is working in conjunction with researchers who know how to identify and frame a problem, it could help by saying, we will crunch all this data that we have and see if we can find something that comes out of it. The same way that...
AI is actually generating new... And this is what's really interesting to me. Yeah. This is something that is a new era in AI, which is it's generative. It isn't just regurgitating existing stuff. One of the things AI is doing, for instance, is protein folding. Remember what you folding at home, where we were all supposed to devote our computer's spare cycles to protein folding? AI has done more in just a few months with protein folding than we did in many years of AI at home or folding at home. It is literally generating new useful information
based on a corpus of existing information and a
set
of
my point
rules.
Exactly. You got to train it.
Yeah.
Right? But it can become generative if it's properly trained.
And most of the AI breakthroughs of the last few years have come from the unbelievably vast amounts of data that have been force-fed to them.
Right.
And so if there are more breakthroughs, they may come from even more data.
I think there is a societal benefit. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the whole point of fair use? And in fact, the whole point of patent and copyright law from to begin with was... You have to, at some point, give up your patent or give up your copyright for the greater good of society.
Wasn't that a big argument when they were sequencing the human genome? Like,
yeah.
I remember Craig Venter being like, I'm going to copyright the human genome.
He tried to copyright it, yeah.
No, I actually interviewed him at the time, and he's like, I found it. It's mine.
Yeah, it's ours. I hate to tell you,
yeah.
Craig.
Yeah.
Copyright is not in our interest, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And copyright, if it prevents an AI from becoming all it can be, probably is not in our interest. And so I think that maybe this, I mean, I know I'm a contrarian here, but I think I think too bad, Google, let the AI read all your videos and not just OpenAI, but every AI.
That's the thing, right? Is it just one company that's becoming incredibly powerful that's doing it versus if we're allowing every AI.
Well, I'm
AI
a big believer
system.
In open and source AI. That's, I completely agree with you.
Whenever we put that note in there, then I'm 100% on board.
So when you say big believer in open source AI, does that also extend to like the data sets that would go into training it?
No, I think they should steal everything they possibly can get. And then the trained sets should be given to us to do whatever we want to do with it.
There's some call very... it stealing. It's, is it theft? That's
reading,
the argument, right?
Reading. Yeah. It's reading. You read Kara Swisher's book. You just told me about it.
Yep.
I didn't have to read it.
Yeah.
This whole show is
all
from reading
regurgitating articles.
Yeah.
That's all we do. I try to credit them, but I don't pay them.
I would also dispute the notion of the term regurgitate because we're adding extra context.
Value. Yeah.
We are assessing and synthesizing different pieces of information to come to a new insight.
That's the whole key. It's generative. There is, you know, I think there's no doubt that their AI is useful in synopsizing existing information. I use it all the time to do that. It's really, really, really useful.
Yeah.
So even if it just does that, that's great. But I think if we can get to generative... Maybe not AGI, but generative AI, and I think we're getting there, where it comes up with new stuff that it has come up with. That's incredibly valuable and a societal benefit. So, you know, these companies spend a lot of money on electricity and processors to train.
Yeah, that's an environmental thing.
Well, if we're going to have a solution to climate change, it might have to come from an AI. I have bad news for you.
Paradox.
It might happen.
Yeah, which will happen first.
Yeah. Let's take a little break. I want to come back and wrap it up and thank our team. And I have a few more stories we could talk about. But first, a word from our sponsor. You and I were talking about this earlier, Micah. Mylio, M-Y-L-I-O. I want to suggest this to everybody who's listening because you can use it for free on one device right now. Mylio is all about taking all of that stuff on your hard drive, photos, videos, documents too, and organizing them automatically, in many cases using AI without putting it in the cloud. We're not talking about giving Google all this stuff. No, storing it locally, working on it locally. It's Mylio, and I have to say it's transformed my photography, if nothing else. For a long time, I've been looking for a solution that lets me store all my photos. And MyLeo, absolutely. I have more than 200,000 photos in MyLeo. It's a private, cloud independent. You can use the cloud if you want to. You don't have to. Platform that helps organize, curate, and preserve a lifetime of memories. All of my photos, all of my videos are connected in a single library. Now, I pay for the pro version of it. It's fairly inexpensive, and that means I can put it on all my devices. But it's free for one device, so it's certainly something you should try. It works with Android, iPhone, Windows, Mac. Get started for free. Sign up for their paid plan to get automatic backups, syncing between devices. It's got duplicate file cleanups and more. They just added a family tree feature that I think is mind-blowing. And this is free. You know, it's very expensive to use some of these, but they are actually tying into the LDS database, and you can actually upload data from your photo library and download data. You can connect. You can create your family tree. You can have others in your family annotate. All of this free, or sign up for their paid plan for more. $9.99 a month or $99 a year. You can organize, manage, and protect an unlimited number of photos and videos across all your devices. And the thing that blows me away about MyLeo is they are doing so much work. Every time we talk to them, they've got another batch of things. You and I just talked to them recently, Micah, a new batch of features. It's incredible. You got to at least try the free version, but if you want to take a full advantage of the platform, you got to get MyLeo Photos Plus. We have a special offer, 25% off your annual or monthly subscription right now. Get 25% off your first year of MyLeo Photos Plus. 25% off if you go to mylio.com/twit25. I kind of want to go up to people and shake them and say, you got to try this thing. You remember Picasa? It was like, this was something Google bought and basically destroyed. This is that times 10. This is the photo. It's with AI, it's so much automatic face recognition, categorization. It's private, and it's on device. MyLeo.com/twit25. I've got all my photos in MyLeo now, and it is mind-boggling. It's fantastic. Highly recommended. Thank you, MyLeo, for your support of This Week in Tech. Google has pledged. Remember Google got sued because incognito mode was not
incognito? Yeah.
It was not private. They said, but we told you it wasn't private. Yeah, but you called it incognito mode, private browsing. Well, they got sued. They lost. And now the latest is Google has agreed as part of its settlement to delete everything that it got. It collected in incognito mode.
Before or after using it to train its AI?
Oh, well, that's a good question.
Before or after selling it to advertisers?
The lawsuit said that Google's marketing and privacy disclosures didn't properly inform users about the fact that when you're in incognito mode, Google still collects all the information about which websites you visit and so forth. The settlement, which was filed Monday in San Francisco federal court, set out the actions the company will take to change its practices. They've agreed to destroy, they say, billions of data points that the lawsuit says it improperly collected. They're also going to update disclosures about what it collects in private browsing and give you the option to disable third-party cookies in that setting. No damages, but individuals can continue to file claims, and apparently 50 have already been filed. So this isn't over for Google, but they're going to delete all of that data.
Interesting. All of those private browsing features are woefully misnamed because...
Yeah, they're all the same.
Because none of them are terribly private, and there are all kinds of ways in which they're not private at all.
They're basically... Don't let my spouse know what I've been doing.
Yeah, that's
is what they basically.
But your ISP still sees everything.
Your ISP knows. Google still knows. Or Safari. It's the same as Safari. It's the same in Firefox. It's the same in all of them. They're just turning off, saving the history. But all of that stuff, you know, you can't. In fact, it'd be difficult without a VPN to keep your ISP from seeing all that stuff. So, anyway.
And even there, sometimes VPN providers sometimes don't do a great job of.
Yes,
making sure they don't know what you're looking at.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, I found the part about this that's interesting to me, I guess, is usually these lawsuits end up being the settlement where people aren't able to individually go after them after that. So
that's unusual, isn't
it? Yeah, this
it didn't
settlement
let them off the hook.
Yeah, this basically. Settlement where it was like, okay, we're not going to talk about money. You just have to delete the data. This is another movie.
Here comes everybody else.
See how that played out in the courts. That it's like, oh, it almost feels like it was just done for good because it's not a money thing involved. It's just like, okay, y'all have to just delete all the data. It's kind of cool.
We talked about Amazon abandoning Just Walk Out. The Giants, the San Francisco Giants, have adopted Just Walk In. The San Francisco Chronicle calls it a new unnerving way to skip the line.
Unnerving is the best part of the headline.
Is it unnerving? So this is one of four teams in Major League Baseball that offer you a way to walk in if you've bought. Obviously, you have to buy a ticket. But you have to sign up for the MLB's new go-ahead entry program. You take a selfie through the MLB ballpark app. Your tickets are on the app. Upload the selfie. Once you're approved, you just walk in to the ballpark. You'll have to barely slow down at the entrance gate on the way to your seats. I think this is great. I don't care.
Is there anything in that story about how long your data is retained?
Yes, where is the data is retained?
Are they going to be selling that data to anybody? Are they attaching things like time and location?
Am I smiling? Am I frowning? Do I have a hot dog in my hand already? Does that bag look like it
has? Take all the fun out of everything.
Yeah. I do. It's true. That's my job.
Does my bag look like it has candy I'm bringing into the stadium so I'm not buying stuff there? Did I sue the company or this ball?
Honestly, I don't think it's still going to have to go through the security line, I'm sure, right?
That's the other thing is that half the time, the people who are actually running the stuff at the gate don't even know about this.
Right.
And so then it's this awkward thing.
Why are you walking in?
I thought I was supposed to walk. No.
Oh, look at this. So here's the little kiosk. It spots you coming. Whoops, let me go back. It spots you coming, and then pops up a green thing and says, go ahead. Oh. You've got three tickets. Enjoy the game.
It shows a horrible photo of your face and movement.
And there are metal detectors and security.
I think you still would have to go through all of that. I can't imagine they're abandoning that.
You have to go to the local USPS and have a little meeting beforehand.
How old are you? Do you have any intention to look at porn? Anyway, Apple is thinking about home robots.
Oh.
Most important story of the week, and I buried the lead.
Oh.
I don't think they're going to. This is Mark Gurman. He knows. The next big thing, the car thing failed. What about robots?
Well, we just saw how they're very, very good at getting Klein bottles out of attics.
That's true. This is from Mark Gurman. He says engineers at Apple have been exploring a mobile robot. They could follow, this is just what I'm looking for, follow users around their home.
And do what?
And also,
I have a dog for that.
They've also developed an advanced tabletop home device that uses robotics to move a display around.
Again, why?
Why?
I mean, it sounds vaguely like Amazon's Astro, which is a robot that, that has a screen.
Remember, it had a periscope and it can open down.
It can follow you around and it does not transform the world, at least yet.
I think this is, if I were an Apple shareholder, I'd be nervous, to be honest.
Can you train the robot to put things away?
If it could fold my laundry,
dishes.
I'm buying it. Absolutely.
Yeah, no,
like,
that's,
hands down.
I've seen attempted laundry folding robots at CES, and they just
always fail.
Oh, it's so disappointing.
And it makes my heart sad every time, because if I had something that folded my laundry for me, I could hire someone. So here I go trying to eliminate humans from. I'm just as bad as these companies. Great.
Yeah, but I'm not sure how many people in the 21st century are like, my brain is so fried from TikTok, all I'm good for is doing laundry.
That's true.
It seems like stairs are a fundamental problem with the idea of a robot that follows you around.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should just stop buying two-story homes.
Well, maybe flying robots. They fly up the stairs while you walk.
Yeah.
Amazon also had that security drone that was going to fly around your house.
Yep. Security drone. I think it cut off too many pet tails. So they decided
my gosh.
No, that was a joke. I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. I thought for real. I'm sorry.
Sometimes I say things sarcastically, but no one understands it's sarcastic. And that's a problem.
It's my fault, really.
Am I fantasizing? Is it my imagination that those laundry folding robots had humans? controlling them?
Probably.
Probably.
A thousand maybe ones
that,
in
I think
India.
There was, maybe there was an ongoing joke that that was the case.
Maybe that
there was
it.
Somebody inside.
They never did that well, right? Did you see something?
Yeah, no, they never. Yeah, they never actually. And sometimes they'd have one, but it'd just be sitting there, and there'd be video of it actually working, but the product itself
great.
Was never turned
that's
on.
Oh, that's so sad.
And you're like, okay, this doesn't work, does it?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm so glad we had a lovely studio audience here today. I'm sorry that we couldn't entertain you more, but I do appreciate your being here, and we have lovely gifts for you. I also want to thank our wonderful hosts for coming in studio, all in studio. Harry McCracken, FastCompany.com. What are you working on?
I can't tell you what I'm working on, but I have a story in our new print issue, which is also online, which is a look at why NVIDIA was our number one most innovative company of the year.
Ooh.
And pretty amazing, isn't it, the success?
They're doing some great stuff, and I got to go talk to Jensen Huang about it.
Oh, nice. Oh, I'm reading that.
Harry's got all the scoops, let me tell
you. And I have my newsletter plugged in, which you can also find how to sign up for at our site.
Oh, nice. And your most recent article, how you're filling the Twitter-sized hole in your life.
With yard work, apparently.
With yard work. I'm sure Marie's really thrilled about that. Harry, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate
always
it.
Always fun. Thank you, Leo.
Editor-in-chief, nojitter.com, Lisa Schmeiser. Thank you for the Girl Scout cookies. Thank you for coming in and being with us today.
Thank you for having
we
me.
Appreciate
this was delightful.
It. Always wonderful to have you on. Anything you want to share or anything you're working on?
Let's see.
Your new podcast?
Oh, I would love to get back to podcasting. I have a Q&A with Cisco's Javed Khan coming up in the next 2 weeks. I just have to finish polishing it. And No Jitter should be continuing to run its coverage on what the big cloud-based companies that are doing generative AI are doing in terms of data protection policies, data privacy, and training data.
You're covering a lot of AI now.
Well, because it's powering so much. Everything from automating communications and workflow processes to customer service. Yeah. So we really have to take a look under the hood and see how it's working.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
Nojitter.com.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lisa. You will be back, Mr. Micah Sargent, on Tuesday for iOS Today with Rosemary Orchard. Wonderful show. Yeah. Now, again, available publicly, audio only for video. Join the club, twit.tv/clubtwit. Thursdays for Tech News Weekly, and of course, every Sunday morning you do
Ask the Tech Guys.
Ask the Tech Guys with me, and it's so much fun doing that with you.
You can head to chihuahua.coffee, chihuahua.coffee. That's where I've got links to the places I'm most active online when I get up the energy to post on those different places.
Well, you need more Chihuahua coffee.
I do. You're right.
Yes. Chihuahua Energy. That would be a good name for an energy drink.
Exactly.
How do you like to vibrate all day?
The opposite of no jitter.
Yes.
It's all jitter.
All jitter all day long.
Passing through walls.
Yeah, exactly.
We do Twit every Sunday from 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific. That's 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern. You can watch us on YouTube at youtube.com/twit when we go live. It is 2100. Am I right on that? UTC? I think so.
I'm the only one here who can do the UTC conversion
in my head. After the fact, on-demand versions on the website, twit.tv. You can also watch a YouTube channel dedicated to This Week in Tech, and also subscribe in your favorite podcast player. You'd think after 19 years I'd be able to say that. Podcast player, audio or video. And, of course, if you're a member of Club Twit, we've got special URLs for you. Twit.tv/Club Twit. Enjoy the eclipse tomorrow, for those of you who observe. and we will see you next week, as I have said now, for almost 19 years. Another Twit is in the can. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye. You can applaud.
Please clap.
They've forgotten.
Amazing.